Good morning, members. I won't call the meeting to order formally because we do not have a quorum yet, but we will start because it is the time. I want to welcome Assistant Commissioner Meyer, and I'm looking here at what you have handed out and just want to congratulate you on a job well done. This has been a long task for you, and we really appreciate the work, and I understand you posted that on your website. Tell me that's true.
Madam Chair, members, yes, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. It went up yesterday. It does contain two different files. However, the first file is the cover information, the three pages of background documents, and then the actual table itself is another PDF file that is attached there. And Madam Chair, thank you so much for the compliment, but actually I need to thank Rachel Hopper and her staff for pulling it together, because go ahead and stand up, Rachel, so people can see who you are. She had that daunting task of kind of herding the cats back at the shop and getting everybody to reply and get all their information in. So it is a step in the right direction. It is, however, a work in progress that we will continue to refine with your input. So any questions or comments you have, please let us know.
Thank you. Well, if you want to finish up, I think we were almost there when we adjourned last time. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. So we're working off of a document I'm happy to say is called Final 3.10.09 up in the upper right-hand corner. And this is the completed spreadsheet document, budgeting for results as we spoke of. We'll be working off the last page, actually page 20, which focuses on the operations support part of the division or the department. This does contain several divisions: our human resources area, our Office of Management and Budget Services, which does all of our contracting and research and coordination work at that level, planning, principal planners, and things like that, and also management resources and the commissioner's office staff. You'll see at the top line here, fiscal 10 and 11, the estimated budget. Without including the Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund dollars, because a lot of those dollars are passed through from the LCCMR, through the DNR, to the grant recipients from this area of our department. So the total is $16.949 million for this area. Under central operations support, commissioner's office staff, we're supervise our regional directors, tribal support, tribal liaison activities, federal boat water safety grants, and conservation volunteer. You can see that represents about 53% of the budgeted amount, approximately $8.9 million, with general fund from last biennium being about $1.4 million. You can see some of the objectives that are out there. The goals that we're really tracking under this area for the department include our energy conservation measures, transportation reductions, and facilities management energy uses. You can see we have a fleet reduction goal that we have there. In 2008, we were able to realize $1.8 million in savings and approximately $10 million over the past 5 years just in the management of our fleet, Madam Chair. Also under facilities, the DNR represents the largest charter member of the climate registry, and we're defining and applying measurement standards to reduce greenhouse gases, greenhouse emissions at all sites. A great example of this is the Camden State Park Visitor Center that we highlight. We need to do more of that. We need to do a lot more of that so we can show the public that it does work, how it works, and so they can have a hands-on approach on that. You can see a couple of the other things real briefly: boating fatalities per 100,000. We talked about that last time, but our boat safety grants do come out of this area of the department, and also the conservation volunteer. Moving on to number two, regional operations support. This is where we deliver those services to the public through regional operations in Grand Rapids, Bemidji, New Ulm, and here in St. Paul, working with interdisciplinary problem solving, public education, and cooperative partnerships for conservation and outdoor recreation. You can see it's about 41% of the FY 10 and 11 budget, approximately $7 million. Last biennium general fund was about $2.8 $2.858 million actually, what we estimated the general fund expenditures were. The supporting programs, as I mentioned, coordination among our natural resources programs, technical assistance, administration of local financial assistance programs, information and education. Here's where our emergency response assistance is coordinated out of at the regional level, and also problem resolutions. This is where we're directly working with those county boards, local units of government, on a one-on-one basis with our regional directors and our regional management team to help deal with the problems and come up with proactive solutions as they occur out in the region. One of the things that I'd like to highlight that's occurring in the regional level is our strategic land asset management program, where we're actually working, sitting down with county boards and throwing up big maps of land ownership and going through parcel by parcel who owns what land and who should own what land. So trying to create large conservation blocks for the state and looking at, in the cases of northern Minnesota, where we have timber ownership, to create larger blocks of timber ownership to facilitate timber management more proactively. It's been a real successful project to date. We're working actively with Roseau and Lake of the Woods County and St. Louis County to determine where land ownership should be. And the Land Commissioners Association do support our activities and are very actively involved in those activities as well. It really is the success, the key, we feel, to successful land management through all levels of government in the future, is making sure that we're purchasing land for conservation value, for recreation value, for productivity at its highest and best use and at the right places, so that we have a strategic land acquisition plan. But we can't do that as a state alone. We need to do it with the counties and the local units of government as well. Finally, Madam Chair, the last section under here, going to page 21, our recreational and local grants represents about 6% of the FY 2010-11 budgeted expenditures. It's about $1 million right now. It doesn't include the Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund dollars. These are the areas where our local initiative grants programs are run out of, also natural and scenic area grants, conservation partner grants, environmental partnership grants, regional park grants, and our remediation fund grants. You can see the FY examples, the 10-11 example indicators there, to acquire for local community projects, acres, approximately 300 to 500 acres in FY 10 and 11. And then we're just talking about the managing grant programs that we have in place that we have discussed in this committee and also in Representative Murphy's committee as well. Finally, Madam Chair, moving on to the change item here, you can just see the next line in this chart. Just talks about summary of the change items on top, and then the summary fund there. The change item that we have in the governor's budget related to the overall department that we're tracking under operations support here is an agency-wide general fund reduction of $3.866 million for the biennium, or $1.993 each year of the biennium. And really, to get to this point, we're going to take a close look. We are taking a close look at things that we've talked about throughout the presentation. We're examining our work design, staffing priorities, organizational innovations and efficiencies to achieve long-term cost savings. We're exploring reductions in the following areas, specifically as it relates to those with management information services, PC procurement, licensing, centralized services, and video conferencing, facilities management, as we spoke often about, site consolidations and closings, making sure that all of our sites are as energy efficient as possible. We do operate over 180 different facility sites throughout the state. We need to make sure that we are where we need to be, but that each site that we have is located in the best place. One of the things that we're really exploring heavily is co-located facilities, working with the counties, local units of government, other agencies, for example. A good example is the War Road facility, where it's a MnDOT DNR county facility, I believe, and it's a great success because we can have state-of-the-art facilities. We can make sure that we all have the things that we need, but do so in a cost-effective manner. So we're exploring that wherever possible. Equipment management, reducing mileage that we drive. It's kind of a daunting number to throw out there, but the department drives about 17 million miles a year. if you reduce that by 10%, that's 1.7 million miles. Yeah, we need to reduce it. But we also need to be where we need to be, when we need to be, kind of, as well. So it's a huge challenge, but looking at things like eco-driving, you may have seen articles like UPS tries to tell their drivers just to take right-hand turns because it saves gas and it's just more efficient that way. But instituting a department-wide eco-driving campaign, making sure that the fleet that we have is the most energy efficient as possible, is something we're really working on. And telemetrics, just how do we get to where we go and how are things transported? And also general administration reductions, other procurement and administrative services, buying what we need, making sure we have what we need, but not buying too much. It's the belt tightening that all agencies need to take place. It's something we'll be working with you and the committee on as we move farther to get more specifics for you to write in the actual bill. But at this point in time, these are an example of the cost savings that we're looking at in that area.
Assure us that this, none of this cost savings will be coming out of programming. It sounds to me this is coming out of management efficiencies as a broad category. Am I correct about that?
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. The programming, under this category, we would not be reducing any programs. And we may be looking at ways to make them more efficient or to operate more efficiently, but we are not examining to put any type of programmatic activity on the block at this point in time under this reduction.
Questions from members? Representative Murphy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Commissioner, last night, several people indicated at our committee on outdoor heritage that there weren't any opportunities really to do hunting or fishing or enhancement and protection in the metro area. And I see here that you've, on page 20, that you have 255,000 acres of undeveloped natural land with high ecological significance. That in itself would dispel what those people said, do you think?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, there are lots of opportunities to hunt and fish within the metropolitan area. I spent several weekends bow hunting out by White Bear Lake on some Ramsey County property this past fall. We also have the Vermilion Highlands Wildlife Management Area. The Vermilion River is a premier trout stream down in Rosemount. We have Carlos Avery Wildlife Management Area up in the city of Columbus, up by Forest Lake. So there are opportunities there. I can provide you a detailed map of where these acres are undeveloped. These would be a group of lands that would provide, some of them would be open for hunting and fishing, but some of them are rare scientific natural areas that we would want to preserve. Some of them are open space that we want to preserve or expand for parkland. So as the metropolitan area increases in size, we need to make sure that we're protecting what little space is available. But there are opportunities within the metropolitan area all over the place for people to hunt and fish. So I'm not sure what people were talking about exactly. I heard their concerns. I've heard concerns from both sides of the argument. I don't want to say they're both right, but both groups have valid points. But I believe that in the metro area, we need to look at conservation as a great tool, just like we need to just look at outstate areas as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We would appreciate those maps, as you suggested, and we will share them as soon as we get them with Representative Murphy's committee. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And in addition to that, I had recently spoken to my own little county, which is Ramsey County, in which we sit, which is one of the most highly populated in the small area counties. And we have 11,000 archery days in Ramsey County alone where people by lottery can hunt for deer. And I guess in Anoka County it's quite popular by the lottery system, and they hunt between 4 and 7 a.m. And it's been very popular. And even in the governor's fishing opener will be on White Bear Lake this year. So that's right here in Ramsey County as well. So I think people don't understand and don't often tabulate the opportunities for hunting and fishing that we have in this metro area. And this is just my own little county.
Good to hear. Thank you. Also, Mr. Mayor, the section that Senator Murphy was reading from says this undeveloped land with high ecological significance. If you all, if when you bring in the map to us, you could help us with flesh that out a little bit, that definition out. What is involved there? Because what I'm understanding is it's a mix of land. So if you could help us out by giving us a little more definition there, or expanding the definition as well.
Yes, the program description here, the outcome description, is focusing on our community assistance outcome activities, who Sharon Pfeiffer from our central region office works with, and I know you've worked with her through the Citizen Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources before, but it is really looking at that metro corridor's next generation type project. How do we, where do we go from here type thing? And I would love to provide you information on that.
That would be great. Representative Gunther.
I just said I wanted a copy of that also.
Oh, great. We will make sure you get it. Representative Joe.
Thank you. And Representative Murphy. There's just a wealth of opportunity to hunt and fish in the cities. You know, my friend Representative Tao is always telling me about all of the experiences that he has. There's turkey hunting. We created a special zone. Representative Hansen created that. There's fabulous goose and duck hunting in the city. In fact, just to the west of the city, just west of 3M, is some of the best goose hunting in the state. And there's a lot of geese taken out in the Oakdale area and out in that area. So I suspect that it's not quite the way some envision it. Also, I think that a lot of people don't know the opportunities about hunting because they think, well, I'm in the metro area. You can't discharge a gun. You can't shoot a bow. You can't do all that. They don't really look into that. And frankly, there is kind of a real patchwork of regulations across the state, but particularly in the metro area, that affect hunting. You have to be knowledgeable of it. So there's just a huge opportunity. And as Representative Scalzi said, deer alone are welcome to be hunted in the metro. The insurance companies love to have them hunted. So that's just kind of my thought about it.
Thank you, Representative Gill, for pointing that out, because it started out at the beginning of the evening where they were saying that they had to go to greater Minnesota to give their kids the opportunities that they had when they were kids. And I thought, well, that shouldn't be, because every kid should be able to learn in their, you know, that field or wherever. And then it was several people continued to make similar statements, and so I wanted a clarification on that. And Representative Powers told me about squirrel hunting. I didn't even believe it until he's convinced me now. Well, and he has his plan.
Ma'am, dear.
Representative Jill.
Well, he does have a plan for squirrels. Repopulation of squirrels that's gaining some traction, actually.
Evidently, it's part of the culture.
But the one thing that is different about the metro, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, versus outstate, you know, as you know, in north of Highway 2 particularly, but not universally, there's vast, vast tracts of open area that people consider to be quasi-public land, hundreds, millions of acres, and that's very different than in the metro. And here it's more of a concentrated, targeted area where you have to hunt. In fact, I like to hunt down here. And it is a little bit of a challenge to understand all of the regulations and discharge laws, but it can be done, and the opportunity is really good. So,
good to hear.
Thank you. Any other questions for the commissioner? I don't see any other questions. Thank you. And
thank you very much.
Thank you once again for for doing your presentation as Budgeting for Results. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have the Public Facilities Authority come and visit with us for just a few minutes. Members, this is not an account in our area, but they are asking for the governor's recommendation is for some clean water money to go to them, and so I thought it would just be helpful to spend a few minutes hearing from Mr. Coleman. He has given us a handout, but I think it's just if you could concentrate not on the base programs, but just on the request for clean water money and what they will be used for, and why they are being requested.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, I did hand out a two sheets of paper. The very first one, top, is just the organization chart, covers the members of the make up the Public Facilities Authority, and everything we do is kind of interrelated with other agencies. When it comes to clean water, obviously, police control agencies. That we work with very closely. The next two pages really talk about clean water budget, and then on the back page, just for information, is the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act summary for the PFA for your information. And I'm hoping all those funds will be spent before the sales tax actually starts coming in for the Clean Water Legacy Program. And most of you are familiar with the PFA, and that we have a revolving loan fund, and then WIF seems to be a very popular phrase when it comes to combining bills, and that kind of supplements revolving loan fund provides supplemental assistance for the high cost project statewide. The Clean Water Legacy when it was passed a couple of years ago before the sales tax amendment, created three programs looking at where they were hoping dedicated funding would go, and looking at areas where the traditional programs don't address key needs as well as the groups, various groups wanted it to. And those three programs that were created in that act were the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program that looked at the very, very small communities under 30 households, between 5 and 30 homes, where they have failing septics and need assistance. The existing programs just really didn't address those problems very well. We recognize the need, if we're going to invest in those communities, if we need to make sure they have the knowledge and wherewithal to operate and maintain the system. So we have created a two-step approach. One is a technical assistance grant they can achieve up front, where they can hire a designer to look at septic replacement and also hire the University of Minnesota Ag Extension to help with a variety of things, from homeowner education, what can go down into a septic system, how to operate and maintain it, as well as working with the local and the government in creating a financial system, a user fees and whatnot, so they can operate and maintain those systems, because we require public ownership. And then the second thing is the actual construction work. It's a loan program. If you have a low-income community, we provide 50% grant, 50% loan. To replace septic, the loan basically 1% for 10 years, and it's just wrapping up. I think we have about three projects, or one project we funded and it's completed, two more that are real close, and I think we have 13 working in various stages of the technical assistance component, and that program is just ramping up. I think PCA has identified 106 cities that have straight pipes, and I shouldn't say cities, I'd say communities of 5 homes and greater, that they have discovered, and roughly about 1,010 communities with 5 or more households with inadequate wastewater systems. And that this also is the Public Facilities Authority, when we looked at all the programs, felt this is kind of a one that we put as a high priority, or as our first priority for the Clean Water Legacy funding. The second program is tied directly to implementing the TMDL implementation plan. When cities discharge into an impaired water, and the implementation plan has been developed, and they're required to reduce certain levels of pollutant, whatever the body or stream impairment is, and those additional requirements over and above their current permit, whatever it costs to reduce those pollutant loads, we consider eligible for the TMDL grants. And there we rely on MPCA engineering staff to look at the as-bid costs and determine which components are necessary in the construction of the wastewater treatment plant to address those that lower pollutant load, and then they certify that cost over to us, and we provide 50% of that cost. So, like as an example, like a municipal wastewater treatment plant might be $10 million, you know, to rehab the plant completely and upgrade it. Maybe phosphorus is the issue, and the phosphorus component may be $1 million. You know, as the cost, we would provide them a $500,000 grant. So that's kind of an example.
Mr. Clement,
of that program.
You said that this is for dollars to upgrade the system. This is what I'm getting, because we are having them do things over and above their current permit. Are these old systems, or are they newer systems, or is it a mix of systems where the permit requirements were just too low?
Okay. Madam Chair, it's a variety of things. For cities, the system is old, needs modernization, growth, that capacity needs to expand, or simply their permit is up and they're required to add additional treatment, so they're just addressing that additional treatment requirement. So it's a variety of purposes. So it makes the actual review of the, you know, the impairment and what goes into it not all that easy for PCA engineers to calculate and certify the cost over. So sometimes it's building a whole new wastewater treatment plant. I think in the case of Wilmer, just start over from scratch. Does that answer your question? But I mean, it is a variety of everything. Just age, growth, new standards.
I mean, the cost to the Clean Water Fund, I mean, this is the first.
Yeah. Are the standards too low? Madam Chair, I'm not a judge of that. I think the standards are fairly level across the state for some specific bodies of water they've always been certain higher standards. Like Upper Mississippi, St. Croix, I think standards have always been a little higher than, let's say, cities discharging in the Minnesota River. With the TMDL studies and impaired water studies being done, I think they're learning a lot more about pollutants and load levels and what's necessary. So those standards are rising. So if you're saying, are they too low and they just need to rise, that may be the case. But, you know, what some cities, depending on what they discharge and where the if the body's impaired or not impaired, may make a big difference in the permit levels that PCA issues. But I'm not 100% sure on that.
We will visit with PCA about that. Actually wasn't my question, but it does beg the question of making sure that permit standards are preventative and not just things that we'll have to, but that's a discussion we'll have to have with PCA, because I know you don't set the standards. My question was really about, this is $15 million. As we finish the TMDL studies in 10 years, or a little bit after, what do you expect that total figure to be?
It will be in the billions, would be my guess.
In the billions?
Yeah. What the TMDL has done to date, I think there were like 320 municipal projects identified. I mean, like a city may have three or four impairments they have to address. So, but there are, and that can relate to stormwater as well as wastewater. It's not just, you know, any point source that municipalities are responsible for, local government entities are responsible for, are being identified. So between stormwater, You're probably looking at $1 to $2 billion in the metro area, and probably another billion on outstate. In wastewater, you're probably, my guess is, looking at preliminary results, you're probably talking another billion to $2 billion. So does this program got covered all? No, but it's in the early phases, it's an incentive for cities to participate in these studies because they know there's some financial capacity or funding available to upgrade their systems. Down the road, I think the legislature is going to have to make some tough decisions on how they're going to address those, or, you know, if the city has 10 years to develop a plan, 10 years to implement once those studies are complete by the fall. So it's going to take time, but there's going to be some big ticket items.
I think it would be helpful if you gave us a long-term estimate of what this is going to cost us, because I think that there is the expectation that the clean water money would be great money to do this and a whole bunch of other things, and the easy math tells us that that's certainly not true. So we're going to have a second plan of action besides the clean water money to deal with these wastewater treatment systems. And it is my understanding that the PCA has not even begun to look at the issue of endocrine disruptors, so we're still designing old systems with and not dealing with a whole group of pollutants that are at this point unregulated. So, and I have the second concern that we're putting money into something that, in shortly, we're going to have to say, whoops, we got to upgrade that again. So to get some sense of the big picture for us, and perhaps Representative Murphy's committee would find that helpful also, if you could share that with us.
Well, I mean, scientific certainty, I can give you our best guess looking at preliminary results.
We're not looking for scientific certainty. We're looking for some budget projections, and that would be great planning.
And the sales tax money, we don't consider it's going to be a solve everything. It's an arrow in the quiver, so to speak. The last program is the Phosphorus Reduction Grant Program, and that is to really to provide some financial assistance to implement CSA's phosphorus reduction plan, which they adopted several years ago in response to numerous lawsuits regarding wastewater treatment plants and phosphorus. To reduce that phosphorus down to 1 milligram per liter, that was kind of a known impairment in a lot of the water, so they started that in their permit process. City came and asked for financial assistance to cover that and push for a 75% grant cost or grant of phosphorus reduction up to $500,000 per treatment plant, with it dropping down to 50% in 2011, and eventually we assume that would just be rolled right into the TMDL and phosphorus treated or built into the impaired water studies. And a lot of communities now are facing 0.3 or less in phosphorus when that is indeed an impairment, and they have to reduce the phosphorus load in impaired water. But those are the three programs, Madam Chair, real quickly, and we're seeking funding for.
Are there questions from members? I don't see questions, but let me just go back to the small community wastewater treatment program. And as you're doing a projection for us on what it's going to cost for TMDL, and hopefully phosphorus is rolled into that, but also small community wastewater treatment programs, what's the big picture here? What should we be looking at? I noticed members when the PCA handed out their budgeting for results, there is a portion in there that talks about upgrading
individual septic system, and it appears to me from what I read, though we haven't had a chance to talk about in community, that the state is spending over $700,000 per septic. That's a state expenditure. Per, yes. I would invite members to look at that because that number startled me, and I thought maybe we would have some discussions in committee. I think that number is startling, and some other members too, if I'm getting the read correctly. But I would ask you all to read, first of all, to look at the outcomes for PCA, because we all know we're going to be facing budget reductions, and this is to help us look at those reductions. And if you would just concentrate on that and see how that integrates with this, because we need some big, big spreadsheets.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think we've been aggressively addressing septic for a few years and growing. This program is designed for those areas where there's a government entity willing to take ownership and property owners are willing, because it's not a forced thing, it's a voluntary thing on the part of the property owners to donate the septic system and the utility easement so the city can go in and install the septic. And we're hoping, when our goal when we create this is if we can solve 10 to 20% of the problems out there through this program, that would be great. There's other tools, Ag BMC program, which we put a lot of money into, and they're seeking additional funding in the sales tax, among other things. You know, they do feedlots and agriculture things, but they also do septic replacement in rural areas. So there's a variety of programs out there that didn't exist in the past. Historically, you'd have to go to Housing Finance Agency or use, you know, the county gets CDBG money, small community CDBG money for housing rehab, and include septics as part of the, and wells as part of the housing rehab component in rural areas. But there wasn't a lot of programs out there. Years ago, when the legislature had the, I'm trying to think of the name of it, but it was the Clean Water Commission or Water Commission or members on it. They set up a grant program in the very first year, $1 million to do septic, and it was a 50% grant program, and that lasted probably about three bienniums, and it got reduced from $1 million a year for first biennium, $500,000 the second, and then $200,000 as budgets got cut, but that was a general fund expenditure. So then there was a period where there really wasn't any activity whatsoever, but now it's starting to pick up and addressing it. Plus there's some, at least inspection and identification when you sell properties and getting some upgrades there.
Now, I appreciate the small community wastewater treatment program. This was not meant to be a criticism. What it's meant to do is we need to have a discussion of what's the whole big picture cost out there, because we see like that elephant, you feel, or something.
Right.
We don't know the size of this elephant.
Yeah, I think PCA completed a study on septics, and they identified 106 great site communities where the septics are connected somehow, and it's fallen right into a stream or a creek. And they may, you know, some of them may just have direct tiles in the house. A lot of them will have a septic tank and no field or grain field or anything, but just connected to a pipe, which is fairly standard in the area of the state where I grew up back in the 30s and 40s, just build that way. They also identified 1,025 small communities, that is clusters of five homes or less, when they did their septic inventory throughout the state. So that's kind of the universe, and yeah, we're chipping away at that over the years, and quite a few septic. That is the universe.
Well, I think that we need a spreadsheet with the universe, the various programs, and what the projected cost out is to get the job done, just so folks have an idea. And if you can help us with that, work with PCA, and we would share it with Representative Murphy's committee. Thank you. We have one more question here, and then we're going to move on. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I perhaps missed the discussion on this if there was one, but I just wanted to go to the phosphorus reduction grant program, and just a comment observation here. It says highest priority of the restoration projects. I just would offer to you that we found that we save our taxpayers a lot of money if we're preventative here, if we look out ahead. We know that from education and healthcare, and I would maybe offer that you reassess that, and if we prevent pollution, we're going to be ahead of the game for our taxpayers. So I just offer that to you.
I don't disagree. I don't think anything too.
Thank you so much, and Representative Purcell can say it, because there's the Bemidji Wastewater Treatment System has a 0.3 phosphorus to protect Lake Bemidji, and they're way ahead of the game, and unfortunately we have other folks that are way behind. Thank you so much for coming. The next thing we're going to do, members, is hear from Representative South on House Class 217. And this is an agriculture bill. It is here because this is an informational hearing only. We are going to take, I would say, we're going to take until 20 of 10 or less. What I wanted you all just to hear it, because we're going to hear it on the floor, and a lot of people have thought of this as an environmental program, and so this is for your information, and so you're ready for questions and ready for a floor debate on this issue, since while it was set up as an agricultural program, a lot of people are selling it as an environmental program now. So that's the issue we're dealing with, and we appreciate Representative Faust bringing it up. And I think that Karen Baker and Steve Heinz are here from House Research to give us just a little brief beginning. But Representative Faust, I appreciate your coming, educating us, and if you would like to start, and then we can hear from Ms. Baker and Mr. Heinz.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for letting me come and present this bill. And what I will do is I will turn it over right away to Karen Baker and Steve Heinz and let them give you the background of the bill and how we got to where we are today, and then I'll pick it up today and describe what my bill does. So we'll go in chronological order. So I'll turn it over to them. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Steve Heinz with the House Research Department. Normally, most of you see me connect with property tax issues, and this is a property tax issue, I guess, but it's also expands into other areas, as you've heard. So we're just going to give a brief background of Green Acres, Karen and I will, and some of the changes that were made in 2008, and that will bring you up to the situation that exists as Representative Faust brought his bill forward. Green Acres started about, and it's technically called the Minnesota Agricultural Property Tax Law. Was created in the late 60s, and has worked pretty much the same way ever since its creation. And it attempts to allow agricultural property that's primarily thought of as being in the path of development to be taxed as if it would continue to be agricultural land, notwithstanding the value that might be coming to the property because of development or other pressure. It does this by instructing the assessor to, for a property that's enrolled in Green Acres, to value the property strictly based on its agricultural value and independent of any other factors that contribute to its value. Landowners who are in Green Acres can remain in it as long as they choose to remain in agriculture. Once they withdraw land from the program, there's a three-year payment of back taxes where the difference in taxes between the two different values of property are computed and collected at the time that land is sold. But if it's sold to a seller, to a buyer who keeps it in agriculture, then no back taxes are due. Any special assessments on the land are also deferred until the land is ultimately really pulled out of agricultural use. What I'm going to give you just a few highlights from is the Office of the Legislative Auditor did a study that came out in January of 2008 and sort of looked at the program and made a number of recommendations to the legislature for changes. So I'm mostly summarizing from their work. And they found that about 13% of Minnesota's agricultural land is enrolled in Green Acres as of that when they did the study. Overall, about $35 million of taxes are shifted off of farms enrolled in the program to other taxpayers, because that's the way the Green Acres program works. It simply shifts taxes to other taxpayers. There's no state payment involved in it at all. And so the $35 million benefit to the farm enrolled farm land is made up by their other taxpayers that make up for that. And in fact, the number is actually $55 million if there hadn't been limited market value in effect. So sometimes you'll hear the $35 million quoted and sometimes the $55. Those are the two different reasons for two different numbers. The legislative auditor found that among some of the reading some of the quotes of their recommendations and their findings, that the Green Acres program's effects on preserving farmland are of short duration. Landowners need not make any long-term commitments to the land, and they found that to be possibly a flawed design element. They concluded that the program's effect on preserving farmland is short-term and tenuous. It is unclear whether the Green Acres program's goals include benefiting some owners and types of land, such as untillable land used mostly for hunting. Certain Green Acres program eligibility criteria, including the income threshold and definition of primarily agricultural, are outdated, difficult to implement. They recommended that the legislature should clarify who and what types of properties should benefit from Green Acres. A few findings about how assessors determine whether they're eligible because of an income criteria, because of primarily devoted to agricultural, what does that mean? They said if Minnesota wishes to preserve land for agricultural uses over the long term, the legislature should consider supplementing existing programs with other strategies. Finally, maybe of their conclusions, they said among beneficiaries of the Green Acres program are people who are not farmers, land with only a small proportion of productive acres, farmland with increased values due to recreational demand, and minimal acreages used largely for hobby farm purposes. The legislature should clarify the types of land to benefit. So that is, I think, just a very, very brief overview of some of their findings, and I think Karen was now going to summarize like what happened in 2008 as a result.
Welcome to the committee. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Karen Baker, House Research. I'm just going to make a few comments about the main changes that we made in 2008. The first one was that a new class of property was created, which we call rural vacant land. Prior to that, ag had been one category or one class, and it was separated into two classes, class 2A and 2B, and with the idea that 2A would be the productive ag land and 2B would be this rural vacant land category. And one of the primary reasons for doing this is so that for in future enrollments for Green Acres, Class 2B would not be allowable, since there was a lot of feeling that what should be in Green Acres was the agricultural land and the productive land. And so there was an attempt to separate. And of course, this occurred, and we have been struggling with the definition exactly of what 2A and 2B is, even though we did put some specificity in law, but we have been fine-tuning it, and Representative Faust's bill goes even further in trying to help assessors to define. Productive, we were trying to get at all the tillable, the pastured, what's mowed for hay, all the fallowed. Where in the non-productive, we were trying to look at the woods and the wastes and the slough and issues that have come up is that there are farms, obviously, or a typical farm doesn't have one versus the other, but it has land that's interspersed with having the sloughs and the rock piles and the ravines and the wind shelters and everything that are in between the productive land. So one of our struggles has been to separate this 2A and 2B. One other big change that was made is that all of the land that is in government-sponsored programs such as RIM and CREP. They were allowed in Green Acres in the past, and but for future enrollments, and I say future because it wasn't current CREP and RIM was not taken out of existing Green Acres enrollments, but for future enrollments, those types of land will not be permitted. And so that was another major change. Lastly, the big change was kind of the grandfather and how do we try and get that land, the non-productive land out. And so what there is in statute is a one-year window, which was up until January 1, 2009, and Representative Fellis addresses that issue as well to extend that. But it's to allow taxpayers to take land out of that and just pay the three-year payback, which is the current payback for Green Acres. What was put in the bill is that if this land isn't taken out in that window, that then there would be a seven-year payback. And the idea behind that was that that particular type of land shouldn't be in Green Acres, and therefore that was an attempt to say, we're letting you take it out at the current, because the three-year is the current level. And that has obviously raised a lot of controversies because now people have had to make a decision. The Department of Revenue sent out a letter with pretty strict or pretty good guidelines to the assessors saying this is when you have to notify the assessor. The January 2009 date is not binding, but tell us what land you think you're going to be taking out, and then the assessor can go through, figure out what the tax differential and value is on this land, and then notify the taxpayer this summer so that by and this fall they would be making the payment on the land that they actually took out. So that's kind of where taxpayers are right now, and obviously they're waiting to see what's going to happen with the session and with the various bills that have been heard and introduced.
Thank you. What my bill does then is it reestablishes or it gives a true grandfather clause to the land that was in the program prior to 2008. When we voted on the bill last year, we were told that there was a grandfather clause, but it actually changed things, and it wasn't a true grandfather clause. I think it was more of a step-grandfather clause or something along that line instead of a real grandfather. And so what we've done is we've gone back and said that if the land was in prior to that, that they get to operate under the same rules that they were operating under before. They get to, have a three-year payback instead of seven. They can break off any part and sell any part that they want to going forward. And so they really reestablished all of the rights and privileges that they had under that in the old program. Then we also reestablished what we've been referring to as Green Acres 2. And so there are different qualifications going forward than what we had in the past. It limits how much of the land can actually be the 2B land. It can only be 50% of the total land can be 2B land. It also makes the land, they have to have it homesteaded in order to be in the program. They also have to produce at least $1,000 of some kind of production per year, or at least be able to do that. The wording that they use, if I can find it, I don't have it in front of me, but they basically normally need to be able to produce at least $1,000 of production a year. So one of the questions comes in if somebody starts a Christmas tree farm and they're going to sell Christmas trees, does that qualify? Well, our interpretation is that it does, because they normally would be able to sell at least $1,000 worth of production a year. There's also includes RIM and CRP can now be a part of the land, and there's been some question whether that's included in the 2A or the 2B land, and I believe that it currently is part of the 2A land, so it's considered part of the productive land. So CRP and RIM and any of those things can now be included in Green Acres program. It also tries to clarify a little bit, if somebody has a shelter belt down the middle of a 80-acre field, some places the assessors are trying to break out those types of things, or a 5-acre slough in a corner, they're trying to break that out. And what it's saying is that all of that land, if it's interspersed with 2A land, it's included in the 2A land. And the reason that that's so important, especially as it relates to the Environment Committee, is that we don't want to have an incentive for somebody to go out there and drain their slough. What happens in my area, swamp land or a grove of trees is valued at multiple times more than good farmland, and because it's considered hunting land, and hunting land is worth more, and so their taxes would be much higher because the value of the land is much higher if it weren't included in the Green Acres program. And so it puts a tax incentive there, sometimes a very high tax incentive, for people to drain their sloughs, to cut down their shelter belts, and from an environmental standpoint, that is certainly something we don't want to do. We don't want any to encourage anybody to do that at all. So I think that is the high point. Did I miss anything? No, I think that's the high points of the bill. So, with that, I'll take any questions.
Member?
Yes, Representative Hackmore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Faulks, I'm a little bit confused about going forward language for new people entering and people that had been in. Particularly when it comes to not necessarily productive land, but former farmland that a family may have inherited down the line, and they've been in Green Acres, and it's not productive, and they've been in the 3-year payback, and everything was fine until we passed the bill last year. Now, land like that that's not productive, is that grandfathered in? Is it going to go back to the same way, or is it going to be under the new rules for going forward? If you understand what I'm
saying. Yeah, I understand your question. And any land that was in prior to 2008, the grandfather clause will actually stay on the land rather than the owner. So if the new owner comes in, as long as they continue to farm it like they're doing, obviously if they build a strip mall in on it, that's not going to qualify anymore. But if they continue to leave it as agricultural land, even the 2B land will continue to stay in as long as it maintains that agriculture status, and as long as they want to keep it in.
Even though it might not be productive land.
Absolutely. Everything that's in it stays in it as long as they want to keep it.
Grandfathered that.
It's grandfathered.
Thank you very much.
Professor
Hanson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Baker, I wanted to go back to the status quo, the issue of, let's say you have 80 acres next to development occurring, and the law as it is now, a landowner can parcel off pieces and sell them for development, even if they are in Green Acres. So let's say if the landowner has been enrolled for 40 years and the property tax has been shifted for a public purpose of keeping that land in agricultural production, but as the years go by, they sell off 10 acres here, 10 acres here, 10 acres here, and then there's a new strip mall and a new housing development, and that public purpose gets nibbled away because of that the land is essentially being banked for development and not for agricultural purposes. Is that the status quo, and does anything in the law change that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, the law pre-2008 was exactly as you described it. A taxpayer could have that land, and as you're using your term, nibbled away and you know, sell off 5 acres now and 10 acres now, and just the assessor would allow any amount of acreage to be separated off under the pre-2008 law. Under the current law, the way it is now, before any changes, obviously, because Representative Faust's bill addresses that. But the way the 2008 law would read is that a taxpayer if that land was productive ag land, and I think that's one thing that we have to separate out, is the changes that the 2008 law made were only in the area of this non-productive which I tried to say was the 2B, and we are struggling a little bit with what should be in 2A and 2B, but for the most part, you know, 2A is your productive, and 2B is this land that is not producing any ag products. And the 2008 law addressed the 2B land, and so in your example, depending on what kind of land that is, if it truly was ag land that the farmer was really producing, then the 2008 law wouldn't have made any changes, and that taxpayer could continue to take off a few acres at a time. However, if the land is 2B land and it's, you know, swamp and trees and land that would fall into the 2B category, then that provision that they need to notify by January 1 of 2009 that they intend to take that land out, and at that point, I said the assessor is going to compute what the tax difference is and what the payment would be now in 2009 on taking that land out. And if they don't take it out, then when they do take out this next little chunk, they have to take all of the 2B land out of their piece of property, and they have to pay 7 years on it. So it really would be a choice that they have to make if that land is 2B.
Madam Chair, if the landowner chooses to take down the windbreak, or if they choose to drain a wetland, they're dealing with statute as well. They're making choices. No one's forcing them to do anything. They're making a choice on how they're managing their land. And the choice is based on somebody else paying the property tax bill.
Was that a question?
I would. Is that true?
Madam Chair, I think that is true.
I guess that kind of gets to one of the hearts of this issue right here. I don't see other questions. Well, does somebody else have a question over here? Did you have a question, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question is for you. I apologize for being gone right at the beginning of Representative Paul's presentation. I walked in right after it started. Madam Chair, is the bill in our possession now, or where is this bill?
Well, it is in our possession. We had asked for an informational hearing on this bill, and the bill was actually sent to us. That wasn't what I really wanted, an informational hearing. We posted this as an informational hearing. We do need to move this bill back to finance. We can't do it today because it's posted as an informational hearing. But that's what we will, and since I said it was going to be informational, in our next meeting we will move it out, and I would recommend without recommendation because it's an informational hearing.
Well, yes. Madam Chair, so I understand correctly, then that we're going to move it without, your thoughts are we would move it without recommendation, but we're going to be, if I am saying this correctly, we'll be moving it forward in the process to allow this bill to continue to move.
Absolutely.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to stay in our possession. Okay.
In the next meeting, we will post it for moving out.
And Madam Chair, if I understand the process right, just in full disclosure, someone could make a motion to change it from no recommendation to move with recommendation, or they could vote no to kill the bill, too.
We are only having an informational hearing on this bill, and we're not amending it, so no, I don't think we are going to kill it. We are going to move it out, and I will technically find out between now and Thursday how we do that appropriately. I believe the appropriate way to do it is without recommendations, but it may be different. But since we posted this as informational, we're not taking amendments, it's going to go out of here under the circumstances in which we brought it here.
So, Madam Chair, if I can ask, so if when the bill is in our possession for a vote on Thursday, wouldn't it be eligible to be amended?
I brought it here for an informational hearing,
And that is all we're going to do, and we are not amending the bill, and so we're not voting on it. Yes, okay. It was never supposed to be referred here in the first place. We didn't ask for the bill to come here. We asked for an informational hearing. Very different. And so I want to make sure technically I'm correct when we send it back out, and maybe it will just be recalled from this committee, and that would be fine with me too. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, I guess this is an assumption on my part, but I think one of the reasons why it was sent here is because of the fear of some of the testimony that we heard and some of the reports that were printed in newspapers and stuff like that, because there were very real circumstances because of this law being changed in 2008 that people were starting to cut down clear trees and the threat of possibly draining some of this the wetlands and stuff like that to start farming. And so there would be, in essence, an environmental impact. So I think that's why it was directed here, so we could hear about it as well. Because if this ground is not taxed agriculturally, you would not be able to afford to keep it in such. And so then you're either going to have to make sure that you can farm it one way, shape, or form. And some of this was debatable on the timberland and stuff like that, why it wasn't classified. And then the other piece would be to protect it from urban sprawl, because you'd have to sell it in order to develop a mini mall or some of the other examples. There'd be no way around it because you couldn't afford to keep it.
I'm sure. I think this evening the tax committee is going to be hearing all the Green Acres bills. Is that correct, mm-hmm. Representative Powell?
That is correct, yes.
Members, I'm not sure, because we didn't request this bill, but it came here anyway. I am not sure how it's going to leave here. So I don't want to tell you exactly what. It may be recalled from this committee before we even return it yet. But I said informational hearing. We're not voting on it. Representative Fortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my question. I was wondering if the Finance Committee was going to recall it and re-refer it to taxes so that it could be properly before the committee tonight.
I don't know the answer to that. We didn't ask for the bill. So that's, sometimes things just happen, and we're going to fix it. So, yes, Representative Faust.
If I can just take a moment and update what happened on the Senate side. It's my understanding that the Senate attached their version of the Green Acres fix to the federal conformity bill. And so that's why it's being pushed forward. And they actually are establishing a whole new program to take care of the 2B land. It does require some extra hoops for people to jump through, but it does kind of get to the same place, just through a different way to get there.
Okay. We'll have one more question, Representative Torkelson, because we are moving on now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an informational question. When this new classification of land was set up, it was up to local governments to reclassify it. Has anyone estimated the cost to local governments for reclassifying these lands?
I don't know that anybody has estimated what it costs, but we have heard from assessors at some of the hearings that they have spent a significant amount of money already doing some of the reclassification, which I think they maybe jumped the gun a little bit and started some of that before they needed to, but there has already been a significant amount of money spent on the county level to do that.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, you know, I come from a part of the world where we have very little green acres, and this has been quite a burden for our local government that is really not benefiting us in any way. And in fact, if Green Acres would come to our area, it looks to me like we would not qualify for the grant. You know, there's nothing to be grandfathered in, so then we are really penalized twice, once for paying for this reclassification, and again because there's no way we can qualify for the old program.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, maybe I should make just a couple comments on that. When we looked at this land, I think it was felt that when assessors are out there valuing, they are looking at all the various pieces of the farm. And they aren't just valuing, I've got a 40-acre piece and it's X dollars per acre. They're actually saying, okay, of that 40 acres, we've got 25 that are tillable, we've got 10 that are pasture, we've got 5 that is a slough and a woodwind. I mean, And it was our understanding that it was, if an assessor is doing a really good job, he's actually got a lot of those pieces separated anyway. And that we really didn't realize that or think that it was going to be that much administrative work per se if in fact they were doing a good job of separating into all these various pieces. And the distinction between 2A and 2B class rate wise was not an issue because the class rate is the same. So it was to separate and categorize them for purposes of obtaining a good valuation. And not only that, but I think the Department of Revenue was trying to work with them to say, you know, this isn't going to happen overnight. We want you to work on this, and maybe it's going to happen in a year or two, but it isn't just going to happen by next year. And so maybe it's more work than we thought, but we really felt that if, in fact, assessors were separating these into the categories that we thought they probably would when they were valuing, that then it wouldn't be as much administrative cost as it turned out in some places.
Thank you for the testimony. Thank you, Representative Faust, for helping educate us about this bill and seeing some of the intricacies of this. Representative Ferguson, I am going to... Is this?
It's a follow-up to her statement, if you don't mind.
I don't want us to run over time, but if...
It's just informational.
Okay.
And you didn't, the law last year did in fact create a new class of land.
Mm-hmm.
We already had lots of classes of land that assessors classified land in, and to create a new class creates extra expense for my local government. Is that not true?
I don't think that's a question I think that's a comment, and I'm glad that you were able to make it. Thank you all for coming to the committee. We really appreciate the help. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, members, let me just tell you what we're going to be doing with the string of bills that are coming up. We're going to hear Representative Doty's bill right now, so if he would want to get ready. And let me tell you that I've been talking to Representative Murphy. We will be sending a number of bills to Representative Murphy, but we are going to have to probably 3 or 4 bills to her. But we are going to have a group of bills, which are our recommendations for the clean water money. We're going to have a group of bills that are our recommendations for the parks and trails money, and some separate bills that have to do with more of the planning process for these bills. So as we hear these bills coming up now, and I'll tell you which category they come in, they will be laid over for possible inclusion for the new money for water, laid over for the possible inclusion of a proposal to Representative Murphy's committee for parks and trails, or laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill, or they'll be sent to Representative Murphy directly. So each of these bills, we didn't separate them by category because that's not the way the bills are coming to us, but we wanted you to know how they're coming. This bill is Representative Doty's, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion in a recommendation to Representative Murphy's committee in the water category. And if you would like to make that motion, Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1325 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Clean Water Fund recommendation.
Thank you. That is what Representative Doty has moved House File 1325 for possible inclusion in a for the new waters money.
And Madam Chair, this it seems like perfect use for the new money. We are looking for things to go over and above what we were able to do before. I have people up here with me that can do a lot better than I can for the details of this, so I'll turn it over to them for the background.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Dale Sutterholm, the Minnesota Geological Survey.
Just in a few words, summarize what the Geological Atlas program is and does. It's a cooperative partnership between the Minnesota Geological Survey and the DNR Division of Waters. The Geological Survey produces geologic maps of several types appropriate for resource management and community planning. Most directly, what we're trying to achieve is to establish where our aquifers are, their size, their location, their water-bearing characteristics, how they're connected to the land surface, where they're recharged and how they're recharged, the relationship between groundwater and surface water features, with an eye towards managing our water sustainably over the long term. The geologic atlases also establish the relationship between wells in a county and the actual aquifers that are in use there so that we can determine what the demand is on that aquifer and how that balances out against what the long-term availability of water might be. The atlases also support more efficient and accurate monitoring of our water supply, and they're useful for stormwater management, wellhead protection, contaminant cleanup. Most of the programs in water then rely upon this information to carry out their business. I did provide a Gantt chart that shows current activities in that program. We've just completed a county atlas of Todd County. We're very close to completing Carlton County. We have completed McLeod County. Carver County will be done in about 6 months. We will hopefully begin two new counties this July under funding from the DNR Division of Waters, and those would be Clay County and Renville County. And then we currently have underway under LCCMR grants atlases in Chisago and Benton counties, which will be completed very soon. And we are just about a third of the way into atlases in Blue Earth, Nicollet, and Sibley counties. I have a pending LCCMR proposal, and if that goes forward, I'll be starting two new counties, one of which will be Anoka, and the other is yet to be determined. So this is an acceleration of this activity in response to new demands for water in Minnesota and problems that have arisen there. We've also provided a map of the state so that you can get a sense of where progress has been and where we're going. That's listed as a priority map. I would just caution you that priorities change with issues that arise and also with the ability of the local community to participate in this program. We require not cash, but at least in-kind effort from the county, and this assures us that they will, in fact, then pick up these products and use them when they're completed. So there is some room for variability there.
My name is Jim Berg. I'm a hydrogeologist with the DNR Waters Division. And we have supplied this pyramid diagram, which kind of shows our relationship to the Geological Survey and how the two parts of the atlases fit together. On the bottom of the pyramid, there are three layers which show the various components of the Part A. What that boils down to is that hopefully by the end of that process, we've defined the aquifers much better, or the geological units much better, which are the containers holding the water, or the aquifers. At that point, the DNR builds on this information by collecting geochemical samples and doing a series of hydrogeologic maps, which sort of end in the ultimate product that we produce, which is a pollution sensitivity map of the county. It can also be used for aquifer recharge, a qualitative understanding of aquifer recharge. And similar to what Dale said, this bill will allow us to build on an acceleration effort that we hopefully will be funded with the LCCMR funding, and allow us to continue that acceleration through fiscal years 13 and 14. And then in addition, there's a whole different set of activities that will be funded by this bill. This bill is structured similar to our 2009 LCCMR proposal, which provides funding for the Part A's and Part B's, and then additional drilling money, drilling and aquifer characterization money. The objective for the 2009 LCCMR proposal was a very specific geologic and aquifer condition, which is the edge, the western edge of the Mount Simon aquifer, trying to understand how water gets into that edge, trying to understand the limitations of that aquifer. With this funding, we would be able to investigate a much wider range of aquifer conditions, because these would be specific to counties scattered across the state in different geologic settings. So in addition to the bedrock recharge and characterization work that we're doing for this LCCMR project, we would be able to do the tasks listed in item 3 of this handout that you've received here. And those tasks, in addition to continuing the acceleration of the atlases, includes expanding our ability to collect core in the glacial sediments, which greatly enhances our ability to map a certain set of buried aquifers. We call them buried sand and gravel aquifers in glacial settings. We would be able to, in counties like Clay County and Renville County, for instance, do a much better job of exploring some of the aquifers that we only vaguely understand, some deeper aquifers that we have very little existing data on. We would be able to begin to expand our groundwater level monitoring nets across the state, so that we're able to keep closer track of water levels in some key aquifers. In counties around the northern metro area, where there's a lot of sand at the surface, we would be able to do more geophysical work, characterizing the thickness and extent of that sand, which is a key component in putting together our pollution sensitivity maps and qualitative recharge analyses. And this would allow us to begin doing investigations in some of the older atlases that are more than 15 years old and that could use a revision with some of our new mapping techniques, and using some of the additional data that's become available since then. And then the last two items relate to some specialized studies that may present themselves along the way, including aquifer tests and more quantitative recharge analyses. And we could perhaps enhance the MGS's effort for well locating with this funding as well.
Questions from members? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the gentleman that just spoke, and I apologize, I didn't catch your name, but is the aging or dating of the aquifers part of your SOP, your standard operating procedures?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. When we produce the Part B's, we collect to date about 80 groundwater samples from existing wells in the counties, and we do age dating or residence time analysis on that water. And then we sort of roll that together with the geology that we've mapped for these aquifers and come up with a much better understanding of how the whole system works.
In my mind, I'm drawing a distinction between age dating and residence time. Those are two different things, two different measurements to me. Is that distinct to you, or?
No, it's different words for the same thing, essentially. Residence time is the more proper term. Age dating is probably more easily understandable by non-geologists.
Age dating meaning, Madam Chair, age dating meaning you're doing some kind of a carbon dating or something on it.
carbon dating is one of the methods we use. A more common method we use is analyzing the concentration of a hydrogen isotope called tritium in the water, which is left over from bomb testing in the 1950s. It has a known half-life of about 12 years, so that if we don't find that in the groundwater, we know that the water has been in residence or is older than about 50 years. If we do find that, then we know that the water is infiltrated within the past 50 years.
Madam Chair, just I don't want to belabor this, but just so I understand, but then you're doing another. Where do you throw hydraulic conductivity into that?
Hydraulic conductivity, the ability of the aquifer to transmit water,
yes, sir.
It can come from any of several methods. The most common and reliable would be a pumping test where the aquifer is pumped for a certain period of time and hydraulic conductivity can be calculated from that. There are other methods that are used as well.
And just that's part of your SOP, Madam Chair? The hydraulic conductivity is part of your...
What we've been doing for the Avises is compiling existing data of tests that are like aquifer tests. They're called specific capacity tests. For a county type of analysis, it's probably more appropriate to compile that sort of information. When we have specific resource concerns, an aquifer test yielding directly a hydraulic conductivity is appropriate.
Thank you.
Are there other questions for members? Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is it Mr. Sutterholm? Is that right? Thank you. Just a quick question on the Mount Simon observation well and well nest status. There's a difference in depth of the well from 310 feet up to 1,000 feet. Are we still in the Mount Simon aquifer, or did I hear correctly that you're exploring aquifers that are deeper, a different aquifer?
Madam Chair, Representative, the Mount Simon observation well program is part of Jim's responsibility, but I believe, yes, those wells are in the same aquifer. The depth difference is just because the aquifers are not necessarily flat.
I don't see any other questions. We really appreciate your coming. The group at the U does outstanding work, and we appreciate what you do for us, and thanks to the DNR for coming. With that, I'm going to lay over this bill for possible inclusion in our recommendations for clean water money. We are in recess until 6:30 in room 5. Thank you, members. We'll see you this evening.
45, be laid over. For possible inclusion in the Parks and Trails Fund recommendations.
Representative Knuth has moved that House File 1445 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Parks and Trails proposal. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1445 is a bill that's meant to use some of the new Parks and Trails money from the constitutional amendment to make some renewable energy investments in our state parks and our regional parks in order to put people to work doing that, to make sure people see that this is a way to create more renewable energy in this state, and then also to hopefully save some money in the long term. And so there would be a grant program for solar energy in our regional parks, and then I spoke with the DNR and got a list of projects from them about where they're looking to put solar energy into our state parks, and so you'll see those listed as well. And I've had some comments about metro regional parks as well as possibly adding some trails to this, because trail lighting in certain areas might make some sense in some of these proposals. And as this bill gets discussed for inclusion in the omnibus or the recommendations, I'm not sure exactly how it's going to go, I would be willing to work on those issues as well. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Knuth, I'm sorry if I wasn't listening when I should have been, but did you mention you're using some of the stimulus money for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, no, this is the new Parks and Trails money. It's not stimulus money.
I think, Madam Chair, I think there is stimulus money for projects like this. I know there's one we have down south in a dairy farm in Faribault County that it brings the payback period of time to 7 years. And I think if you can access, if you're ready to have these things done in these public buildings, in other words, if you put upon enactment at the date that it's done, that you can get ready, get as much of it as you can before anybody else.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I agree with you. I hope our agencies are working as hard as they can to get that stimulus money and to bring it to Minnesota. I'm going to be working on that issue as well, and I think I'm happy to have the federal money do it as well as state money. I think they can complement each other.
Representative Clark, thank you, Minister. I just have a question. Now, these are limited to regional parks.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there a reason they couldn't be broader than regional parks?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I did make the comment, and I'm assuming you're talking about Minneapolis Park. And I've spoken with someone from the city of Minneapolis, not their park board, but I would be willing to open up to metro regional parks as well. It was not an intentional part of the drafting.
So when you are defining regional parks here, it's not to include the metro parks as a regional park system? Or it was not?
Madam Chair, I want to include regional parks both in the metro area and in outstate Minnesota. There's some areas that don't have state parks, and I think they should be able to apply for these as well. If that excludes certain parks in the metro area, I'm willing to amend the bill to make sure that they're not excluded. I don't want to be doing that. And then I'll talk with staff between now and when the recommendations are made to make sure we get that clear.
What we have to make perfectly clear here is this is the proposal is for constitutional money, so it can only be spent for what the Constitution allows. So small parks, local parks, are not included in what the Constitution allows, but the metro park as a regional yes. system would be allowed. Is that?
Thank you. I was just thinking of some of the discussion we had, and I think you provided some leadership on that, like some of the lighting and stuff that we've been talking about. Why aren't we doing solar and so on in some of our corridors that are, I think, considered regional, but they might be in the city. So anyway, if there's a way to work on that, I'd be glad to support that.
Yeah. Representative Smith? Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I would be happy to work on that with you, and I know and making sure we're in the parameters of the Constitution and yeah. and what this money was meant to be spent on and invested in investing in solar, I think would be a good use of that, and making sure the parks that are eligible for it are included in the bill. I will work to make that happen.
Thank you. Any other questions for members? And I think I'm understanding that folks are asking that possibly trails be included in this. Am I hearing correctly?
Madam Chair, yeah, I've spoken to some folks about that, and I think if they're of a regional significance and they are allowed with the Constitution, then I'd be willing to do that, but we need to make sure they are before we go down that road.
Any other questions from members? Any other questions? Then House File 1445 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Parks and Trails Fund recommendations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Junkie, welcome to the committee. And I will move House File 1348, and you will tell me where, I mean, you just had a small discussion with me about where it can go, so I do need to hear that again.
Madam Chair, thank you. And no, this bill, just the motion finds for possible funding by the Clean Water Fund. And that's you're laying it over for that, right?
Yes.
Okay. You're hearing the bills and making those decisions, which is great. And I've got people down from the Candiac County area who are going to do this. So
let me, I'm going to put this formally on Representative Bugimia, moves that House Bill 1348 be moved for possible inclusion in the clean water recommendation.
Correct. So, Madam Chair, we're going to explain our clean water project for one of the gems of Minnesota, which is Green Lake, and I know a lot of you are familiar with that. That's, for those from there, I don't know if there's anyone from St. Paul here, but that's the last time they built the big ice castle in St. Paul, the ice came from Green Lake in Candiac County. So, one of the cleanest lakes in the state, but needs some help, and I'm just going to turn it over to them for their presentation, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You put your name on the record?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. My name is Greg Rolrood, and I'm the chairman of the Green Lake Property Owners Association in Spicer, Minnesota. This organization has over 500 dues-paying households around Green Lake. The city of Spicer, with a population of 1,100, sits on its 3 miles of Green Lake's 12 miles of shoreline. I and three of my colleagues will present a 15-minute briefing about Green Lake and how we believe you can help us. 15 minutes will not be enough time to cover what the whole story and all of our plans, but experts are here to answer questions that you may have. We are here today to highlight two problem areas with Green Lake. The first problem is that Eurasian water oil was discovered in the lake in 2000, and it is spreading more and more with each year despite our successful treatment efforts. The second problem is the need to reduce stormwater inlet pollution, which is feeding the milfoil and causing water quality degradation from increased levels of phosphorus, nitrate, and sediment. In many places, what once was sandy bottom is now weedy, and what were clean shoreline rocks are now green with algae. I would still describe Green Lake as a healthy lake, but it is at risk of becoming impaired, and we are concerned about that. The Property Owners Association has for a number of years treated the milfoil with approved herbicides and has used scuba divers to remove certain milfoil stands. We've also been active in trying to ensure that the stormwater runoff is handled better, particularly now with a new road construction project in progress along the South Shore. Last summer, concerns about stormwater runoff in the city of Spicer led the property owners to approach the city council about two specific runoff areas that are causing particular pollution concerns. The council agreed with our concerns and proposed that the council join with the property owners and the watershed district to form a partnership to address the concerns we all have. This in turn resulted in an association with other entities, and we are now known as the Inlet Partnership Group. The Inlet Partnership Group met for the first time in October 2008, and it now includes representation from the Green Lake Property Owners Association, the City of Spicer, the Watershed District, Candiac County, Minnesota DNR, and Minnesota DOT. For years, each organization has been doing what it thinks is right to protect Green Lake, but I believe individual organizations cannot succeed in isolation. With the creation of the Inlet Partnership Group, we now have a cooperative movement of many diverse entities whose synergy has already helped us make progress towards solving the problems I've mentioned and other problems we face. This progress would not have occurred otherwise. The solutions to the problems of sedimentation, nutrients, and the increase of milfoil cost more than the combined budgets of the partners. Therefore, we respectfully seek your approval of our request for clean water funds for a 2-year period to help us attack the problem. At the end of that time, we will provide you with documentation of projects completed, the results obtained, and with the hope that our plan will prove to be a successful model for other areas of the state. Our volunteer work and agency efforts have accomplished a lot, but we can accomplish even more with your financial assistance. To talk more specifically about our plan, Jay Michaels, our contract engineer, and Ted Anderson from the Watershed District will brief you, followed by a summation by Ron Schneider. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Jay Michaels, and located in Kandy, Ojai County, Green Lake is a central Minnesota gem. Its 5,400 acres are the lifeblood to the city of Spicer. It's also an economic and recreational driver for Kandy, Ojai County, and all of central Minnesota. It's provided generations of memories for both permanent and summer home owners. Fishermen flock to its waters. Even in the winter, it's a mecca of activity. But Green Lake has a problem. It's called Eurasian water milfoil. It was first discovered in 2000, and since then, the frequency of occurrence has grown from 4% in 2004 to 20% in 2008. Much of the problem can be attributed to stormwater runoff. To understand the problem, we have to learn a little about the development impacts on the water cycle. In a natural area, very little of the rainfall that hits the earth runs off, less than 10%. Most of it's infiltrated and the rest evaporates, completing what's known as the hydrologic cycle. But with development comes impervious surfaces, and that changes the equation. Suddenly, what used to soak down into the ground is now running off, which leads us to the first problem we have to deal with, a water quantity impact. Our flood peaks are higher, they last longer, we get stream bank erosion and habitat loss, so automatically, as we increase our water quantity, we're going to decrease our water quality. Then along come the pollutants of concern, these things called non-point source pollutants, the nutrients, pathogens, sediments, and toxins that make up the number one water quality problem in the United States today. In our case, we're mostly concerned about nutrients and sediments. In recent years, due to increased residential and commercial development within the watershed and highway and road improvements, the associated impervious surface increase has affected 32 stormwater inlets around the lake. These inlets bring a significant amount of sediment and nutrients into Green Lake with each runoff event. A strong correlation can be made between the location of these inlets and the establishment of the Eurasian water milfoil.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Chad Anderson. I'm the administrator of the Milford Crow River Watershed District. Water quality issues in and around Green Lake have been thoroughly studied, both before the establishment of the Watershed District in 2005 and after. This includes annual lake surveys conducted by the DNR, Clean Water Partnership Phase 1 study, water quality monitoring, and others. Without going into much detail as to the results of the water quality monitoring that has been conducted over the years, I wanted to bring to your attention some of the results from monitoring inlets into Green Lake. I ask you to note the horizontal red line along the bottom of the graph, along the very bottom. It's noted as 18 parts per billion of total phosphorus. The 18 parts per billion comes from the aforementioned Clean Water Partnership Phase 1 study, during which the water quality goal of Green Lake was listed as non-degradation. In order to meet this water quality goal, Green Lake must maintain average annual readings of 18 parts per billion of total phosphorus. These are just a few of the inlets leading into Green Lake, and most, as you can see, of these inlets are averaging total phosphorus readings in the hundreds. So monitoring of the inlets paints a startling picture of total phosphorus inputs into the lake and indicates the need for mitigation. Heavy investments have been made into the protection of Green Lake's water quality already, including, but not limited to, the county and property owner investments into a centralized sewage collection and wastewater treatment plant that goes around the lake. There are no individual septic systems on Green Lake anymore. Stormwater-free treatment along 14 miles of Highway 23, land donations and construction of stormwater ponds, monitoring and feasibility studies for potential corrective actions on stormwater quality, as well as numerous person hours and volunteer time that have been logged as well. And these efforts indicate a very strong desire of local as well as state entities
to do everything possible to continue protecting the lakes. We'd all like to take further measures to guarantee a greater return on the millions of dollars that have already been invested for protection of the lakes, which is why we're here today. Another indication of local willingness to protect the lake is with the Green Lake Property Owners Association, which has an extensive network of volunteers, including some who actually went through a DNR-approved training in order to scuba dive and actually manually remove some Eurasian water milfoil from small patches around the lake. The strong desire of the Green Lake Property Owners Association, as Mr. Roverud was referring to earlier, has led to the Green Lake Park Inlet Partnership, which is a very unique structure of a team made up of stakeholders from around the area, including local residents, as well as state, county, and local governments. The partnership has been working since September of last year to investigate the most effective ways to address the nutrient, sediment, and Eurasian water milfoil issues affecting the lake. This proposal is one of the partnership's results.
In addition, Madam Chair, for the last 2 years, the Middle Fork Crow River Watershed District has been studying the problem, looking for opportunities to treat stormwater runoff before it enters the lake through the use of innovative stormwater management practices. The Watershed District has identified a series of improvements to the most problematic inlets and their contributing watersheds that, if installed, would dramatically reduce the sediment and nutrients that are feeding the lake and the Eurasian water milfoil. Combinations of these methods will be integrated for the best design to reduce pollutants generated by each one of these inlets. These solutions include biofiltration and infiltration and rain gardens, as they're known, to treat stormwater and runoff to reduce nutrient loading. Channel stabilization to reduce sediment and the associated nutrient loading. Treatment of runoff in vegetated swales done with native plants to filter the water before discharge to Green Lake. For the Eurasian water milfoil control, we're proposing a thorough and consistent professional annual survey of the abundance and the location of growth of the milfoil and control by approved methods consistent with the Green Lake Vegetation Management Plan. A big part of our project is community education, showing people within the watershed what they can do in their own backyards to reduce sediment and nutrients from reaching the receiving waters. We've also included an extensive pre- and post-construction monitoring program to evaluate the success of our project. Our project budget is $780,000. Our goal is that this pilot project will become a benchmark for stormwater management and Eurasian water milfoil control throughout the entire state of Minnesota. Who does the work? The fiscal agent for the project is the Middle Fork Crow River Watershed District, who will also act as its administrative agent in cooperation with the Green Lake property owners, the City of Spicer, and Kandy Ojai County. Technical support for the project will be provided by Emmons and Oliver Resources, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Transportation, the Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the Kandy Ojai Soil and Water Conservation District. The consequences? Well, the consequences to Green Lake of not taking action is the further degradation of water quality, accelerated sedimentation and nutrient loading, and the proliferation of Eurasian water milfoil. It isn't often that we have the chance to save a lake.
Good evening. My name is Ron Schneider. Our family has had a home on Green Lake since 1978. Those of us here have come to know Green Lake intimately at different times in our lives. And as we see this lake today, each of us has a mental image of how it looked when we first saw this magnificent body of water. Frankly, we're somewhat embarrassed that we didn't do more to protect it from the harm that has been caused to it by the activities of people who claim to be improving the land around the lake. Now, we cannot undo that which we should have done, but failed to do, either through ignorance or sloth. But we seek redemption by doing all that we can to rehabilitate Green Lake and to restore it, using both the knowledge that we now possess and by acquiring new knowledge about what ails this grand lake. Today we are in a race against time and the elements, because with each passing day, more sediment enters the lake, bringing with it, among other things, more phosphorus, which results in even further water degradation. So we are here seeking the help of the people of the state of Minnesota, knowing that time is of the essence, and we sincerely thank you for allowing us to share our concerns with you.
Your concern is one shared by many lake associations in Minnesota. So let me just ask a question. In 2002, you had some money from Clean Water Partnership. Was that it? Could you help us out here?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We completed a Clean Water Partnership Phase 1 study in 2002.
Did you apply for Phase 2 money?
Phase 2 money was applied for, but was not granted.
I think perhaps one of the questions we need to ask, that was a popular program, and folks generally thought that program was the thing that we needed for Minnesota Lakes and was doing well, but the governor's cut its funding again this year. So I think we have to have a discussion about that particular issue. Second question I had, when you had tested it, I think it was in 2002 that you tested?
Are you referring to water quality monitoring?
Yes.
We've been conducting water quality monitoring from the time before the watershed district was formed.
Well, you were testing for sediments and nutrients. Have you tested for toxins and heavy metals too?
In these particular inlets, no, ma'am. We have not.
What if one of those things was the problem and you weren't catching it because you weren't testing for it?
Madam Chair, I think that's a very valid question. I think that one of the restrictions that we're always working with when we do conduct water quality monitoring is the availability of funding and to conduct an entire suite of metals and other toxins as well as the nutrients and suspended solids. It would be prohibitively expensive. That being said, under certain circumstances, perhaps under certain locations, we'd be able to spend a little extra and search for other issues such as heavy metals.
And I was just curious if when you applied for the Clean Water Partnership originally, did you ask for a larger suite of tests and you were denied, or did you only ask for those two?
Madam Chair, unfortunately, I'm not able to answer that question. The Watershed District was formed in 2005, and I've been with the Watershed District for 1 year, so my apologies to not be able to answer the question as far as the application of the CWP.
Well, it's a wonderful thing that you all have a Watershed District. That is a huge move in the right direction, so good to hear that. Other questions from members, Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for one of the testifiers. Can you tell me what tree planting for hydrologic damage is?
We have several, Representative McNamara, Madam Chair, we have several opportunities in proposed parks that where we can utilize tree planting as one of the tools of stormwater management.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up. Well, thank you, Mr. Michaels. Mr. Michaels, are you referring to rainwater gardens where it may be understory plants, or is it actually trees?
Actual trees.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up again, can you give me an instance of where we would, and what kind of a tree we would plant that would provide hydrologic benefit? I'm serious. Mr. Michaels, I've known you for a long time, so you may think I'm being facetious, if that's the right word, Madam Chair, but I'm serious.
Well, Representative McNamara, considering the number of trees that you've planted over the years, I would The typical ones that we would be looking at would be willows, dogwoods, rapid growing aspens and poplar.
I don't see any other questions. Do you have a final word for us?
Well, Madam Chair, we just appreciate your time, and I appreciate the group coming down. I tried to keep them concise and to the point and as short as possible. And I do hope you are observing that they are working on outcomes and other things that we know are important here. The other thing I'm just going to leave with you later on, but I want to tell the group, this was brought to me today, too, by the group, and it's truly telling on what we're doing in Minnesota, and it worries me. In my hands, I hold the 2008 statewide strategic plan for a region water milfoil in Idaho. This is what Idaho did last year for a strategic plan for water milfoil. And I'll point out, here's the Minnesota plan in the back of the book, three pages. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to work with you and this committee, as well as maybe our noxious weed folks over in agriculture and other places, to maybe develop over the next couple of years and require that our state put together some planning and control for erasing water milfoil in Idaho, like they did in Idaho, and not ignore the problem anymore like we plainly seem to be doing. That's just my editorial comment, but I'll leave you this book because it's kind of cool.
I don't know whether DNR would want to respond.
No, we don't want them responding.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A Representative Dunkey, I have a lake in my legislative district that has been battling raising milfoil and some other noxious weeds, and the homeowners around that lake have put in a significant amount of their own money. I'm just curious, the residents around Green Lake, what is their... how much have they put forth so far to date, and how much do they plan on putting forth for these efforts out of their own pockets in the future?
Two things, Madam Chair. Number one, yes, the Green Lake property owners every year control water milfoil and put out of their own dues dollar amounts every year for that and for monitoring and everything else. So, yes, they're putting their own dollars into it. Secondly, the reason we're doing this, I hope, will help your homeowners eventually and every homeowner. What we've proposed here is something that actually came to light. I actually had Senator Chaudhry out, who is very familiar with the area, and we did some surveying and visits around Green Lake together this summer. And he's the one that actually pointed out, Madam Chair, that rather than just controlling like our lake associations tend to do, either with chemical or mechanical or other controls, that what we really have to do is try and get to the reason that milfoil is growing in a lake that it should never be in to begin with. This is a sand and gravelly bottom. It's a very deep lake in the middle. This is not a lake conducive to milfoil, yet it's there. So Senator Chaudhry pointed out, and is also working in the Senate with this group, that what we need to do is discover the root reason. We think it's these inlets that showed up about the time that the milfoil showed up. And so we're hoping to prove through these experiments and other things we're doing in monitoring and outcomes is show that there is a cause and effect that may also be causing, I suspect, in your district, it's a lake that's got development around it, too, and we may find out some of the problems for some of this milfoil. So two answers, a little longer than you wanted, but yes, they are putting in dollars, and hopefully this will help all developing lakes in the area of the state where milfoil is to understand why it may be there.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Junkie, it would be helpful to get the actual dollar amounts. You maybe don't have them off the top of your head, but if we could get the actual dollar amounts, that would be helpful. And
I can sure get you that.
That'd be great. And not to be a killjoy, but I got depressing news when I visited their lake association, and once you get milfoil, you can never get rid of it.
And I agree, Madam Chair, and that's why we need to minimize it, and I hope eventually for your lake owners and mine, get a better comprehensive plan on how we do go about addressing this with biological and other controls that certainly are available if you look at the worldwide research on it, too.
We all, one of the other things that we need to revisit is perhaps the chemicals that we are putting in have some unintended consequences for our lake, and we haven't studied that either because we're seeing changes with some chemicals that while we think they're helpful in the short run, they may be harmful in the long run. So that's another issue that we need to deal with. We haven't gotten there yet. Representative Kristoff.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'd just a couple of comments and kind of an observation here, if I may. And I thank you all. That was a good presentation. You've got a plan that sounds very, very well constructed to me, and I applaud you for that. I did want to take, and we were talking this morning about NPDES discharge for phosphorus, and I want to take this opportunity to point out why we really need to ratchet back on phosphorus. And I think the young gentleman there talked about we had 18 parts per billion is what's recommended for your lake water. Our NPDES discharge in Minnesota is 1 ppm. That's 1,000 parts per billion. We're putting in way more phosphorus than these lakes can use and we're in our ordinary sewage treatment processes. I just want to point that out because those are long ways between those two numbers.
I think that's good. Thank you all for coming. I am going to renew my motion to lay House Bill 1348 over for possible inclusion in the with the Parks and Trails recommendation. Thank you all for coming. And now we have. Oh, I'm sorry. It was the Clean Water Act, Parks and Trails for the Clean.
Madam Chair, we're quickly hooking up here for the next one. And Madam Chair, while I know you want to study this for possible inclusion in your bill, I also want it over in my committee, and we could do that with paperwork shuffling and finance. We don't have to leave. So with your motion, if you could round it up for me for a bit too, and I'll send it back or do whatever you want me to when I'm done with it.
We could do it that way if that's what you prefer, Representative Junkie. I will move House File 977 that it be recommended to pass sent to finance.
We'll send to Ag and Veterans Finance because it's already in the Finance Committee. We just want to come over to my division, and we can shoot it back to you.
We will give it to Finance, and they will take care of
okay.
it for us. Welcome to the committee.
And again, Madam Chair, this is the Let's Go Fishing bill. You're familiar with it. We've got the we got a couple of folks from the office in here. They want to show you just a short video that's been produced for this, and then briefly visit about the program, answer any questions you have. Again, this is a bill and a group that's extremely popular in the state. I'd say one of the niftiest programs I've ever run into, and I have some suggestions for it at the end too, but I'll let them do their presentation quickly and then we can answer questions.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you that we could take some time to share the program with you. Since 2002, this program has grown to be extremely popular and really well received on Minnesotans, where we served approximately 18,000, 10,000 last year. The good news is that in the past funding that we've received, we've done exactly what we said we would do with it. The numbers have been there. The communities have embraced it. The challenge that we have going forward is that it's become so well received that in the next 11 years, we will have more people, according to Minnesota numbers, we will have more people age 65 and older than K through 12 combined. So with this program, not only do we feel that we're laying some very good groundwork for those seniors, but we are also doing a very significant work, as this video is going to show, coming up with our new program, and that is the intergenerational, which we're really excited about. We launched it last year in 2008. We had 1,500 kids out, and we've got a lot of seniors, semi-retired and retired, that are pulling beside a lot of these youth, getting them back out in the water. It's been extremely successful, as has the veterans. So with that, we'd like to share this video with you to give you a better feel of Let's Go Fishing. And
over the years, I've seen a lot of different programs whose purpose was to get more people out on the water fishing. Let me tell you about one that truly is unique and quite remarkable. In a nutshell, Let's Go Fishing is a community-based organization with individual chapters that are governed by a local board of directors and staffed by trained and dedicated volunteers. A small cadre of full-time professionals oversees and guides these local chapters. All of these caring people work very hard to provide a positive, memorable experience to community residents who might otherwise never have an opportunity to get out on the water. On any given day, spring, summer, or fall, Let's Go Fishing could have 200 or more guests out on the water throughout the state of Minnesota. Weather permitting, these community-based chapters usually schedule outings Monday through Friday from mid-May through September. Hey, last year, Let's Go Fishing took out 10,000 people. You heard me right, 10,000 people. These people came from nursing homes, assisted living quarters, hospice programs, healthcare facilities, senior citizens clubs, senior social groups, senior apartment contractors, and the general public. Many of these guests would never be able to enjoy the great outdoors, breathe this fresh air, or enjoy a scenic view while fishing or cruising if it were not for Let's Go Fishing. In addition, kids have been on board as well. Lots of kids. Of the 10,000 people served last year, over 1,500 participants were kids. All the outings are free, no charge whatsoever. Each local Let's Go Fishing chapter provides all the equipment and supplies for an outing. The whole nine yards is all provided. Once a person gets to the landing, all they might need is a fishing license. For some, if they reside in a care facility or are disabled, a license may not even be needed at all. When an outing is scheduled, guests will have the choice of going out in a small three-man fishing boat to do some real serious fishing, or they can choose to go out on a Let's Go Fishing pontoon, which has been designed specifically for the safety and comfort of senior citizens and those guests who may have physical limitations. Safety and comfort, of course, are never compromised. Since 2002, the Let's Go Fishing mission has been to enrich the lives of older folks and the physically challenged. And now even younger participants with our new intergenerational program, some great times have been had on the water by grandparents and their grandchildren. Yes, through their fishing, boating, and outdoor encounters, Let's Go Fishing works hard to build relationships, strengthen communities, and of course, create lasting memories. Over the years, I've seen a lot of programs, but this one, like its motto implies, is truly making a difference with people.
Community involvement is the thing here. That's the real key, the building blocks for a successful Let's Go Fishing chapter, because so many communities already care about their people. It's a natural fit. The Let's Go Fishing model, that's why it's so successful. Local folks taking care of local folks.
For example, Harvey and Helen Hawkinson of Wilmer celebrated their 65th anniversary underwater with Let's Go Fishing, while thinking about what they would like to do to honor the occasion, they decided that they would like to go fishing, like they did when they were younger. After a phone call from the Wilmer area chapter, arrangements were quickly made and the couple enjoyed a fishing trip anniversary on beautiful Green Lake. The Wilmer area chapter was honored to be a part of their day and wished them many more years together. Now that's grassroots service.
As of January 2009, Let's Go Fishing has 18 chapters and continues to grow. With 26 additional chapters targeted by 2011, LGF will have an extensive statewide Minnesota coverage. Wherever there are sufficient accessible bodies of water, an LGF chapter is possible. If you are in any way intrigued, motivated, or interested in our program, please contact us direct.
Who are the Let's Go Fishing volunteers? Well, they come from all walks of life, but at its heart, they're caring people, both men and women of all ages. They're all individuals who have a strong interest or feeling for the outdoors and who want to do something that can make a difference. The core of the Let's Go Fishing volunteer program is the seniors themselves. Young retirees are becoming more involved in serving those who are older. These men and women not only have additional time in their lives to help others, but also bring a great deal of experience and expertise to the program. They relate easily to their fellow senior guests, pay tribute to the veteran on board, or show patience to the youngster trying to make their first cast. We've noticed that once a volunteer dons our distinctive dress, our hat, tee, sweat, or jacket with our special logo, a transformation seems to take place. That woman or man becomes a friend, a mentor, a motivator, and a caregiver. It's actually fascinating. A Let's Go Fishing outing can be as enjoyable and rewarding for the volunteer as it is for their guests. As the Let's Go Fishing program continues to expand, more volunteers will be needed and new opportunities will emerge. For a rewarding and really enjoyable experience, consider volunteering in your local chapter of Let's Go Fishing. It'll change your life and the lives of others.
The statewide home office of Let's Go Fishing has in the past received support through various means, one of which is matching grants from the state of Minnesota. So for every dollar LGF raises, the state matches 50 cents. LGF, just like so many other nonprofit 501c3 operations, needs to find people, organizations, grants, and gifts in order to continue to operate. Needless to say, every little bit helps.
Since its inception, Let's Go Fishing has attracted the attention and support of well-known companies. Let's Go Fishing is grateful for the support these companies provided through monetary and equipment donations. These companies include One Boats, Mercury Motors, Berkeley Fishing Equipment, Northland Tackle, Linder Media, and Urcoa Pontoons. These are just some of the many friends who support Let's Go Fishing.
As mentioned before, the state of Minnesota has been generous to the LGF program through its matching grants. Let's Go Fishing is very thankful to the state of Minnesota for its support and belief in the vision of LGF.
Just a priceless idea that they had of giving seniors a chance to go out and enjoy themselves.
Okay, we're in the sunset of our lives, and the stars, the cloud over a little bit, and there's nothing more interesting than to get out with friends.
This program of Let's Go Fishing is one of the best things that I have seen lately.
You have to be looking.
Well,
I'll
do that again.
Yes. There we go. Well, there's nothing better than this, does it? Right.
No.
To learn how you can make a difference in the life of a senior, you, or if you would like to bring the spirit of Let's Go Fishing to your community, visit our website at www.lgfws.com or call toll-free 888-235-8448. Hey, together we can make a difference.
do have want to make a few comments. We are going to move along fairly rapidly here because we're keeping folks out late.
So again, Madam Chair, again, we're requesting, and they can certainly talk about it too, some monies we're adding, at least suggested, and they've suggested adding a veterans program component to work with our veterans' homes and our legions and VFW clubs to incorporate that into it. That's why we want to see it in our committee. We think that's a healthy thing to look at. As you can see, they're adding the youth component. I will also say, Madam Chair, that we are not married to the Game and Fish Fund. This is how it was drafted last year. It was redrafted again this year. They need another 2-3 years of funding, and they should be totally self-sufficient. Is what we're shooting for. Once they get to a certain critical mass of chapters, just like a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout organization, then you become self-sufficient. They're almost there, and in fact, last year the request this year is less money than last year, and again, they're fully willing to do the matching funds. I'd also point out before Representative Bill walks out of the room that if you're really looking for money in the Game and Fish Fund, again, I know where you can raise $1 or $2 million with a two-line stamp too. So I want you to keep that in mind easily. But I also want to say that this is very compatible in any of the programming. We've asked the DNR in the past, frankly, to help us and become partners in this more so, like the Min Aqua program and other things they do so well. And they have been helpful in a lot of the guidance they've given and other things, but we haven't quite got the incorporation there yet like I wish we would have. But again, Madam Chair, I have 35 authors, and we had others that wanted to get on this bill. As you can see, there's chapters all over the state. We're coming into the Twin Cities area and your areas and lakes. We think it's just a marvelous venture that they started here and a vision they have, and we want to continue it.
Okay. Let's see if there's anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill or comment on it.
I'm assuming Mr. Myers is coming on to testify for. That's all I can guess.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Bob Myers, Department of Natural Resources. You can see this is a great program. Our main concern is one of the funding source. That Game and Fish Fund, we've been testifying for the past 3 biennium now that it is an inappropriate source of funding. Should this funding go through as well, it will total $975,000 this program has received. We want to make sure that there's the highest level of accountability attached to these dollars. We're in the process of completing an internal audit. Once those findings are completed, I'll pass those on to you. And I think we need to make sure that we understand that some of these dollars are being used for fundraising activities. We all know what happens when you use state funding for fundraising, and we want to make sure that everybody's on the up on that. So those are our main concerns, is that the funding that you folks appropriate to this are coming from the right source and that they are being held accountable. And I know we do have a person from the Budget Oversight Committee that would like to testify as well, Madam Chair.
We'd be glad to have them.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. My name is Scott Nagel. I chair the big game portion of the Oversight Committee, as well as sit on the Budget Oversight Committee. If you recall, several years ago, this was put together with a $350,000 package with our review of their progress report. After reviewing those reports, we would recommend that this be rejected simply because it's inappropriate spending for the Game and Fish Fund.
Pretty straightforward. Of course, it's also equally straightforward that our general fund money is going to be substantially reduced. I think that's a given, and we all understand that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson, did you have a question? Thank you. Is this the appropriate time, Madam Chair? A couple of things.
I wanted to ask, what is your overall budget for your organization of Let's Go Fishing, and how has that changed from its initial year of operation?
My name is Craig Norenberg. I'm Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. Our budget for 2009, the calendar year, is $557,000. And the original budget back in 2002 was probably a couple hundred thousand. I wasn't around at that time.
$175,000. And Madam Chair, I have a series of questions here. So out of the calendar year 2009, $557,000, how much, what is the breakdown as far as expenditures go? Where does all of your budget money go? And then how much of that goes into capital equipment, and how much have you purchased in the capital equipment since the inception of the organization?
Madam Chair, and I would like to, from the beginning, zero of the money has gone toward capital. Every one of the communities throughout the state raised their own funds for all of the equipment. So I think that's important to know. As far as where the funds go, one-third goes toward support of existing chapters. One-third goes toward starting new chapters. And then one-third goes toward administration, marketing, and that is the makeup of our budget.
Madam Chair, when you say support to existing chapters and new chapters, what do you mean? What do you mean? Just so that they have their own operation funds and.
Yes, they're responsible for their own fundraising, and so they raise approximately $10,000 to $15,000 a year. Each chapter is what it takes, and it's community sponsored, and so that's what. Raising their own funds, what they do.
So does that include, do they have administrative costs then that come out of that third?
There is one administrative cost, and that is $2,500. That comes to the state organization. Our insurance bill alone is over $30,000. And then we've got the auditing. We've got the marketing. We put all of that into one package that we all share equally, so it all goes out into hard cash.
Okay. Madam Chair, are there any salaries associated with this then at all? Or?
We have two full-time, we have two part-time on the state office.
Madam Chair, it might be helpful, we're trying to have greater transparency, and I was actually a co-author on a bill that when we give out grants from the state that we have greater transparency for the citizens of Minnesota. And since you have been a long-term recipient of grant money from the state, I think it might be helpful if we could have kind of a historical perspective of your organization's budget so that, citizens of Minnesota know exactly where the tax dollars are going and how you operate as a entity.
We would be glad to get that for you.
Thank you.
If you would give it to us, we will share it, and we will also, when we get the report from the DNR, we will share it. The using of state dollars for fundraising has its own set of laws, and we will make sure that folks have those laws before us, so we're meeting the spirit of the law as well as the letter of the law. So we'll try to bring those things in. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Junkie, thanks for it's a cool program. I just have a number of concerns, probably along the line of Representative Anderson. I don't know if this question is for you, Representative Junkie, or for Mr. Norenberg. Did I catch in the video that was there 18,000 participants? Was that so far in the program, or was that in last year?
That was inception to date. Representative, Madam Chair. Yeah, the number was 10,000 for the calendar year 2008.
10,000, thank you, Madam Chair. So it was 10,000 for the calendar year 2008. And do you know, was it more last year than in 2008? Was there more in 2000? I'm sorry. Your budget is for 2009 is 557.
Okay.
Thank you. So, 10,000. I did a quick. So, are you telling me that it's like $50 per person going out to fish? Because was your budget last year? If it's this year's budget, 557. What was last year's budget?
Last year's budget was $460,000.
Okay, $460,000. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be sure I have this right. So $46 per person that's going out fishing is what the budget was. Of that, let's see, it would be $300,000, if I remember, was last year's budget. So $30 for state money for every person that went out fishing. Okay, then my question is, you said one-third of the money is used for support, one-third for new chapters, and one-third for administration. But I also want to clarify, is that all labor? Is that all administration? Because you talked about only two people, full-time and two part-time, at the state office. Is there other offices where people work and are getting paid from Let's Go Fishing? No.
Well, with the exception, we do have one part-time staff person at a chapter level.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So we have two full-time employees and three part-time employees total. But I think that's what he said, two full-time and two part-time at the state office and one other part-time employee?
Madam Chair, I think what he meant, if you have a chapter, they have a part-time person that gets some compensation from the local chapter for running the local program. So there's a part-time person at each chapter. Is that what you said?
No.
Well, just
one.
There's two full-time, two part-time at the state, and there's one part-time at one chapter.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Nornberg. I thought that's what you meant, but both Representative Junkie and Representative Anderson thought you were saying different. So. So that I understand, did the video, the shirts with the logo, the pontoon with the logo, the matching life jackets, the pontoon boat said the Buffalo chapter on it, I noticed that. Was any of that stuff paid for with state money? Because I thought you said no equipment was bought. I was assuming that was what some of the state money.
Yeah, Representative McNamara. No, none of that was paid for with state monies. When a chapter starts out, their initial cost is $38,500. Okay? The community raises that. That purchases the pontoon, motor, and trailer from a manufacturer. All of their marketing, all of their fundraising, all of their shirts, are all a part of the package that the community purchases for that dollar amount.
Madam Chair, so the only thing I think is left is the overhead then and staff. That's what the state money is being used for, and that's coming down to you're doing some fundraising. It seems like it's not quite a one-to-one match. But last year, it cost about $50 to put somebody on a boat to go out fishing for a day under this program. Do I have that right?
Not exactly.
$46.
We'd be glad to get you the exact numbers, but I think what's really important here is that before you can start a new program, a veterans program, a youth program, there ends up being a ton of time put into a program of research and development and nurturing it along. And it's kind of a rubber band approach where you're pulling and pulling and pulling, and it seems like it's cost, and then pretty soon it all comes together and takes off. So in the front end, what seems to be more cost per person, which it is not 46, it's even lower than that, and that's why we need to Madam Chair, if we could get the hard numbers to you in regards to that, if that would be okay.
I think let's get the hard numbers, and then we can have some questions then if you would like, because the bill is coming, going and coming back. Would that be all right?
That would be fine, Madam Chair. I'm glad that it is costing less than $46 for you to put somebody in a pontoon boat. And I'm interested to hear if it's $42 or $43 or whatever it is. I think it's important, folks, to know that our Game and Fish Fund is currently taking money from the hunting side and putting it in the fishing side. And the Oversight Committee has found that we need to control the cost in regards to fishing. And I think we have to be very careful. And this is a neat program. I like the idea of you getting Ron Chera and the lenders up there advertising it and raising the money from the private sector. I think that's where this money should be coming from. I really think this is, excuse the phrase, but this is going down the slippery slope using this state money, game and fish funds, from a thing like this. I just don't know that it's appropriate.
Well, and again, Madam Chair, we didn't do that last year. We had general fund. It was just drafted that way. We are not married to the game and fish fund. We're just here asking for you to make the decision on where it goes. So, really, that's up to you, the committee. We used general fund dollars the last 2 years. Again, when I asked them to draft upstairs, and I guess I should have done a delete all amendment or something, they just drafted it like they drafted it in the past, even though we have not funded with the game and fish fund last year. So, I just want to make that clear. And you're getting a chapter in Hastings.
We will take two more questions and then send this bill on, because it will be coming back. Representative Hamilton, did you have one of those questions?
Just a real quick one, Madam Chair. $30,000 worth of insurance you purchased, does that cover all chapters, or do the local chapters have to carry supplemental insurance of their own as well?
That handles all chapters.
Thank you. Representative Gunther, did you have a question?
No, I didn't.
Okay, Representative Clark, did you have a question?
I did. I think, Representative Gunther, you said something about your coming to the metro area. I'm interested in to know what that means. From listening now, it sounds like if there were an inner-city group that wanted to start one, they'd have to come up with $38,000 to start a chapter. Or is there some help for that? Or
That is correct. We help you in the fundraising, mm-hmm. but it comes from local dollars.
Okay, and just one other comment. Okay. My dad's going to be 93 in a couple months, and he still carries a fishing pole in his car, plus fish. But I noticed down right on the corner of the state, there's not one down there. So I'm, in addition to representing an inner city area that may or may not, you know, be interested, I just think, I'd like to tell him about it, but he'd have to travel quite a long ways to participate. So I don't know what your plans are. I'm just interested in general what your plans are for expansion. Besides Hastings.
Yeah, I'd be glad to answer that, Madam Chair. The plans for expansion are solely based on what we have for the budget. The immediate ones that we have up there, we've got Duluth that would like to start. They're in the process. White Bear Lake, they're going to be up and running
from southwest Minnesota. She wants to know where we, Lyon County is.
Okay.
Wherever there's water, we need water to make this flow.
Remember, I'm going to renew my motion that House Bill 9767 be recommended to pass and return to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
It's passed. Okay, and now we are going to pick up our pace, members, because I know that we have a lot to do, and we're not going to be here quite as late as the committee was last night. Representative Hanson, you have House File 345.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I would move House File 345 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Clean Water and Parks and Trails Fund recommendation.
Representative Hanson moves that House File 345 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Clean Water and Parks and Trails Fund recommendations. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have with me Len Price. A couple weeks ago, he presented a lot of background in terms of what the Minnesota Conservation Corps is able to do based on our past experience. The bill in front of you
allocates money from several funds to the Minnesota Conservation Corps. The first one is for the Met Council through the Parks and Trails Fund for work in the metropolitan area on maintenance, restoration, and other improvements at metro parks of regional and statewide significance. The next one is to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for flood prevention and natural disaster emergency response. The best model for this would be what we did in southeastern Minnesota 2 years ago with a very similar project. With anticipated flooding in the Red River Valley, this would be very timely. Second, the item C is for the Parks and Trails Fund to the Minnesota Conservation Corps. An agreement with the Commissioner of Natural Resources for work at state parks. That's because this one is a little different because the MCC has a joint powers agreement with Minnesota DNR. And then finally, D is for surface water monitoring relating through the Pollution Control Agency. On the back, you will see item E, which has been a source of some controversy, and therefore you will find the A2 amendment, which removes the appropriation for that just has a requirement if there's a fee or easement purchased with the Outdoor Heritage Fund that it be GIS mapped. And I would move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape of what I would like it in.
Representative Canston moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. Representative Canston, do you want to say a few more words about this? Or
would you just have Mr. Price be available for comments or questions? I would ask Mr. Price, you and I did work on this bill together in developing the bill. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Len Price, Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Thank you, Representative Hansen. We did meet in Representative Hansen's office and talked about the funding in the past that the MCC has enjoyed from the state, many sources, and we sat down and talked about what we do, and this bill is a result of that discussion. Representative Hansen has been notable in his support of MCC programs. We're looking for a way to sustain what we do now, and B, a way to expand what we do in the future. We think that the Minnesota Conservation Corps is a good investment of state dollars. We can do a variety of work. Our past experience in dealing with a multitude of partners has been very good. We are transparent and accountable. I think Representative Hansen forwards electronically the report that we filed about the Board of Water and Soil Resources money that we received 2 years ago. We have a report that's required to be presented to the chair. It's filed with the legislative library and it's available electronically about the use of the general funds and also the natural resource dedicated funds that we received. We've shared with you our annual report, which delineated the revenue sources, the outcomes and results of our work. We just want to work with as many partners as we can, restoring resources and giving young people an opportunity to be outdoors and work with their hands and change their life.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Gunther has a quick question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I talked to Mr. Jasky from Bowser, and he talked about how he was very happy with the work that you did for him, and he was very happy telling me about the floods in southeastern Minnesota, and if you haven't realized it yet, the Red River Valley is about ready to come over the banks now, and that's going to be a problem in the very near future, and it's going to be nice to know we have somebody to take care of those problems like this. Conservation Corps. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Guster, we're not in the flood prevention business, but I understand what you're saying. We have responded to floods throughout our history, and not only in the emergency aspect, but also in the recovery aspect. As our annual report highlighted, we did a lot of recovery work in southeastern Minnesota after the huge rains 2 years ago, and there's still work to be done. So we hope we will be continue to be engaged in those activities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Price, I know that one thing you're dealing with, the possibility of being involved in putting some folks on the ground with the federal stimulus. Do you feel comfortable that you'll be able to to meet the potential demand on your services and staff with both this front and the possible federal stimulus fund.
Madam Chair and Representative Vancouver, thank you for that question. I can share with you that our program folks and staff have been wrestling with that question, and part of the answer is already upon us. We were asked 3 weeks ago if we could deliver 50 people to work in the Superior National Forest this summer with federal stimulus dollars. We did submitted a proposal, and we found out earlier this week or late last week that we will have 7 5-person crews engaged this summer in the Superior National Forest doing trail work. That's one of the federal agencies. We've also been approached by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service, for starters. We don't know what else. We are exploring all the possibilities for other funding sources that can help defray the cost. We think we have the capacity to double our core member enrollment. That would be, we currently, throughout all of our programs and over the course of a year, probably engage 200 individuals. So we'd be trying to get to 400. I don't know if we can succeed in doing that by the end of 2009. But we can continue to work on that over the course of the following year. And our, I mean, people have talked about us in the CCC. The U.S. Army ran the CCC. They had remarkable resources. We don't have those financial resources, and we don't have the human resources. But we're trying very, very hard to create jobs and also provide these opportunities, and we're going to give it the best that we can.
Thank you. Representative Hanson, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, and ask the committee for support.
Okay. Well, we're going to lay it over. You're going to renew your motion to lay it over for possibly.
To lay it over for inclusion, yes.
As amended. Okay. We're going to lay it over and go on to Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins, I will move House File 63 and have it be laid over for possible inclusion in the Parks and Trails Fund recommendation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate your hearing this bill. I can tell you one thing, I won't be very long. This is actually my sixth bill today that I'm having heard, so that's why I'm celebrating St. Patrick's Day. This is almost misnamed. This is it's a $4 million request for Heritage Village Park, and you'd question, now why should we do that, all that money for just a little park in one particular city? And the reason for that is because it goes beyond just being a park for one particular city. It rests along the Mississippi River, and when it floods, we get that 100-year flood like so many places do about every 10, 12 years. During the 10 years that I was mayor of Inver Grove Heights, we had the 100-year flood 2 times. And when that happens, we go down there and sandbag, and we do our darndest to try to save homes and businesses, and we don't. They eventually, it overcomes the sandbags and the temporary dike that's been temporary since 1969, and it floods all these nice homes and businesses and these nice folks, and we cause, or we incur, between the state and the feds and the city, anywhere from hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars of damage every time it happens. The recommendation that we got was up, both from up and down the river, was get those homes and businesses out of there. And we've been in partnership with the state for many, many years now and doing just that on a voluntary basis with those homeowners and businesses. We've been buying them out. We're having some success in that. We're right at the precipice. We're right there, ready to get it done and let this baby flood as a park. Then that helps both all of the nice folks up and down the river from whom we got that recommendation. So that's why we're here with the request. I'm joined by Eric Carlson, who's the director of the Parks and Recreation Department for the City of Inver Grove Heights, and he can walk you through it a little bit more, but that's about all the voice I got left from the sixth bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let me just ask about your relationship with Metropolitan Council, because they have a proposal before us, and they pull together all of the proposals in the metropolitan area. Are you part and parcel of that process?
If I might add, and then I'll certainly let Griffith or Ms. Carlson address it, but this is the reason why I presented it as a separate bill is because it's somewhat unique in the fact that it's not technically, you know, it's a park and it's part of the Parks and Trails, but it's also so important because of what it does for the entire river. And this goes well beyond the metropolitan area. that's why we present it as an individual bill, in addition to the fact that we have had a decent relationship with the Metropolitan Council as well. With that, I'll let Mr. Carlson address it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, because it is a city park, it wouldn't qualify for Metropolitan Council funding. But Representative Atkins is correct. We are trying to mitigate areas that are prone to flooding, and we have been relatively successful through the years in doing that.
I think, Madam Chair, if I might, it doesn't qualify for the Met Council because it's a little too small. The folks up and down the river love it because it's like 70-some acres that would be allowed to flood, but I think it's got to be 100 acres or something like that for it to be important enough to the Met Council folks to include in their plans.
If it doesn't qualify under the Met Council, and I understand what you're saying, have you worked with DNR to see, because they do a lot of the flood work for us and we do flood grants?
We have. We have successfully received grant funding from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to help us in acquiring properties, both private property and businesses in the area. And we have purchased properties from willing sellers with DNR grant money, along with city money and other funds as well.
The problem is, Madam Chair, we just keep coming up short of what was in the city's contributed a lot. The county, I think, has pitched in, but we can't quite get over the hump where we can actually let it flood. And that's the point.
Does DNR have anything? Is there anybody left from DNR? I don't see anybody from DNR. We will have a conversation with DNR. Any questions from members? Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, so I'm just on like looking at your map here. So would you be able to run as part of this? You'd be able to run on a trail or a bike all the way from Hastings to South St. Paul? Is that part of this?
And thank you, Representative Lilly, for the question. Thank you, and the softball, I appreciate that too. This is part of the trail that would run all the way from St. Paul down to Representative McNamara's district. It's part of the Mississippi National River Regional Trail. And quite frankly, we're struggling also to get that complete. This would allow us to fill in that one section so that Representative McNamara then could ride his bike all the way from Hastings here to the Capitol. And plant trees along the way.
And plant trees.
That might have been loud enough to chill up on the tape. I meant, no, I can't, not because I wouldn't want to, but I'm not in physically good enough shape to go that far. So I've got a great new bike, Madam Chair, from my wife.
Well, we're all going to be taking lessons from Representative Lilly. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 63 be laid over for possibly season in the party and take the trail fund recommendation. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you.
The bill is laid over. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I will move that House File 60 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance Omnibus Bill. Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair and members, you just got a promotion, Madam Chair. I would talk a little bit about the bill.
Or demotion, one or the other.
Pardon me?
Or demotion, one or the other.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. So House File 60 establishes the Des Moines River Valley Trail be recognized as a state trail and require the DNR to work with Friends of Jackson County Trails to develop a plan to link the trails down in Iowa and then also over to the Casey Jones Trail. Madam Chair, with me I have a testifier today. He is the chairman of Friends of Jackson County Trail. It's Chuck Luce.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Luce. It's spelled L-U-C-H-T, not pronounced that way, but I am chairman of Friends of Jackson County Trails Association. We've been in existence since 1998, promoting trail building in Jackson area. We want to now go get authorization to make a state trail that will connect up with Representative Magnus' trail, the Casey Jones Trail, that we can go on here. our connection between our county parks and the Dickinson County Trail System, so that we are actually going to be connecting with another state now with our trail system as we go. The state trail then would someday go from the Iowa border all the way up to the Casey Jones Trail. Now, we're not asking for money, we're just asking for authorization to talk with the DNR to start working on that trail. We've worked with the DNR several times already. We applied and received grants to do shoreline restoration along the Des Moines River, along our trail, where we planted the first year about 8,000 plants, native plants and grasses, to help beautify alongside the trail and along the parts that the trail went through. We received another grant last year, and I don't remember the exact number of plants last year. It was a little bit smaller, but we put in a second grant. And so we have a history of working with the DNR and going on with that. We also have great support with the county government in our county. In fact, we've gotten letters from Cottonwood County to the north and Murray County, where the Casey Jones Trail is, promoting our to go with the state trail from the Iowa border. And Cottonwood, Jackson, and Murray County. So we're trying just, now we just want the authorization to start doing more planning and more going in on that. We get money from ATP grants for the trail we built so far. And if you go to the Jackson County site, county government site, you can see maps of our system. One thing why we're going interstate now is there's two organizations countrywide starting to develop a mapping system of bike trails across the whole country. They have dreams of connecting coast to coast on bike trails someday. And we just want to be part of that and start going within the state of Minnesota into other states. And if any of your communities have trails that go from state to state or from Minnesota to another state, tell Representative Hamilton, because we're trying to find that out. I see a lot of plans. People want to do it. We have the first one that will connect, is already connected to Iowa now, built. We're having the grand opening this summer. But we've gotten $50,000 from an estate to help with our trail plans. Bank Midwest in Jackson gave us a pledge for $10,000. Plus we get $10, $5, $20, $100 donations from campers that use our county park system, people that live in town that use our trails. One of the guys that I work with has lost over 135 pounds using our trails. So we do get the local support.
Questions for members? This is a committee that hikes trails, and we congratulate you for your work that you've done so far. That's very good.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I was just wondering, there's no dollar figure in here. Did I miss that? Because for the DNR to work with you in planning and developing, there's a cost to that. And I'm wondering if you have an estimated dollar figure for this.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, right now we have to have the authorization, and this bill authorizes it. And what we'll do is start working, talking with the DNR, and seeing what our future cost will be. We are looking at getting in line for the trail portion of the 3/8 inch sales tax that was in there, and that's what we're looking at now. But the cost right now is we need the authorization before we can go ahead and just talk with the DNR.
I think we are going to have a chat with DNR about this, and I don't see anybody here, but we will ask them to come before the committee at another time and talk with us about this.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, then, I would like to renew my motion that House File 60 be laid over for the possible inclusion in the Environment and Finance Omnibus Bill.
We will lay it over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming and sharing your success story. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative Magnus is next. Representative Magnus, welcome to the committee.
Senator, I'll move the bill.
Representative Clark moves House File 30 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the environment finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Clark. I was feeling sorry for you when we were talking about the Let's Go Fishing thing, because when they said in your response to how about us down there in South Lake, they said we had to have a lake, and you don't have one in your area. So I'm trying to think of you, Representative Clark, in your old home area, because this bill, members, this extends the now famous Casey Jones Trail, since the last presenter talked a lot about it, extends it about 20 miles south into Rock County. It currently is going from the little house in the prairie land up at Walnut Grove area through Murray County into Pipestone County, and we want to extend it on from Pipestone County down to Rock County. Members, I do have a fiscal note from the DNR. Again, we're not asking for any money. We're just asking for language in statute that extends the trail on. So I do have a fiscal note that shows no cost to the state for the trail. So in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, that's basically it, committee members.
Thank you, Representative Magnus. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Clark, would you like to renew your motion?
Chairman, I will renew the motion to have House Bill 230 laid over for inclusion.
Okay. We'll include that for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members.
Who's next, Chair? Looking for anybody else here that's here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson has a bill scheduled. If he's not able to be here, he's had to go home for a family emergency. Unfortunately, members, I don't know if you heard the news, his wife has been diagnosed with cancer since we left today to go home. So Representative Hamilton and I said we would step up and help him with his bill. Mr. Chairman, I've brought the bill forth some years in the past. And Mr. Chairman, if you and the committee wish to do that, we would be very pleased if you would hear the bill for us. But we'll try to do the best we can to.
I believe that's appropriate, Representative Gunther.
I'll move House File 661. Be passed and roll over the omnibus.
Representative Gunther has moved the bill. If you want to speak to the bill, please, up there, have one.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 661 is appropriating money for floodplain management, and it is $140,000 for 2010 plus another $140,000 for 2011, and it would transfer from the general fund over to Bowser for a grant area 2. And, Mr. Chair, we have Carrie Netsky with Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Projects here to testify. So at this time, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to the testifier. Or Madam Chair, sorry, switched over.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Terry Netsky, and I am the coordinator for Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Projects Incorporated, based out of Marshall, Minnesota. I think I get the award tonight for driving the furthest. I'm here today on behalf of House File 661. We were requesting the continued funding of $140,000 annually for our work involving the regional floodplain management within 9 counties of southwestern Minnesota. Before you, which you were just received, is just a short booklet that summarizes our purpose and the work that our organization does with flood damage reduction. Go ahead and look at that as you'd like. I'll go ahead and speak about our 31-year history and the work that we do with the state of Minnesota. Area 2's approach to flood control over the past 31 years has basically been to stop the water where it falls. We construct the floodwater retention in a stair-step fashion down the slopes of the Cotoda Prairie, which is more commonly known as the Buffalo Ridge.
The Buffalo Ridge, of course, is more famous for the wind turbine generators on it than any of the flooding that it causes. What makes the Buffalo Ridge so enticing is the elevation drops of up to 80 feet of vertical drop per mile in the La Paul River watershed, and it goes down to about 50 feet per mile of vertical drop in the Redwood watershed. This is a big contrast to the Red River Valley, where the flooding is always so publicized, but they just have a few feet of drop per mile. So you can see that our flooding differences are great. But due to these very steep slopes, the rainfall and the snow melt, they gain extreme erosive forces, and it makes flooding an annually occurring nightmare for the people who live here and make a living from the land. Area 2's proven approach allows for a landowner-friendly and voluntary solution to control the erosive forces of these floodwaters, while we also further reduce the degradations of stream banks that add the sediments and the nutrients to our already impaired water. Recent studies indicate that 65% of the sediment of Lake Pepin stems from stream bank erosion. If any of you are familiar with southwestern Minnesota, you know what our stream banks look like, and that's why we need to slow these waters down. This region of Minnesota has a long history of flooding dating back to 1916, when the Corps of Engineers investigated flood control efforts on the Yellow Medicine River. You might ask why our organization has that 31-year history of service. The five major watersheds within Area 2 suffer from a very unique and a secondary form of flooding called crossover flooding. Not only do our floodwaters flow off the Buffalo Ridge into the Minnesota River, but because of the slope of the Buffalo Ridge, it can also go from, if you can imagine, Ortonville to Mankato, basically jumping one watershed to another. The Yellow Bank goes into the Yellow Medicine to the Redwood, to the Cottonwood, and on down. So essentially, our flooding is twofold. The reason for my testimony today is to explain our continued need of administrative funding. If I may, I'd like to draw your attention to the fourth page of your booklet that you received. It has a yellow tab on it, and it is a graph entitled The State Funding Synopsis. This graphically illustrates our past funding appropriations, both administrative and project construction, for the past 13 years. I'd like to draw your attention to the yellow bars, which is the administrative portion of our funding. Dating back to 1978, when the Area 2 organization was created by statute, $250,000 of annual funding was provided by the state of Minnesota. The amount continued through the 1980s, when it was reduced to about $189,000, which was still a very adequate amount to achieve the organization's intent. That funding level remained until about 2001, when the Ventura administration made efforts to eliminate all joint powers organizations. Of the 10 joint powers boards at that time, only 3 survived, and we were one of them. Survival also meant a 25% cut to our administrative funding, so from $189,000 down to $140,000. In 2003, another 25% cut came, reducing us down to $105,000 annually. That's a total of 45% within a two-year period. The member counties remained committed and continued to provide that 25% match to the original $189,000, and they still contribute over $85,000 a year for administration and project funding. In 2007, we were successful to get a partial increase back to the $140,000 funding level. An additional strain to our budget is the lack of a professional engineer that is mentioned in our statute. The former engineer retired in 1998 and was never replaced due to state budget constraints at that time. Area 2 now hires consulting engineering, which consumes just another chunk of our budget that wavers up and down. Area 2 has successfully proven that it can do more with less, as the budget cuts have required us to do. This long-standing successful and beneficial partnership between Area 2 and the state of Minnesota needs to continue, as the purpose and the need is the same just as it was 31 years ago. By doing our part to reduce flood damages and to keep the sediment and nutrients on the land at the headwaters, we are bettering the Minnesota River and the Mississippi River for generations to come. I thank you for your consideration of our request and appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to field them.
Members.
Okay.
Anyone in the audience have questions or comments on this? Representative Sanders.
I should say I'll renew my motion.
Okay, Representative Clark, did you have a question?
I just had a question about the photo. I'm trying to understand
and I don't know if you know, but on page, is that 2008 project example?
Mm-hmm.
I can't see that. Is one supposed to show before and the other after? Or
Madam Chair, committee members, yes. These are before and afters of just three of the about 14 projects that we built last year. Actually, if you look at the very bottom one, this is an example of the stream bank sloughing that we have that is so prevalent in our area. And they are befores and afters. Okay, I'm having trouble seeing how this spot is the same place as that spot because of the trees, but maybe the trees grew up or something, I don't know. It's just another oxbow. There were three oxbows that were repaired. I believe it's just a different one.
Okay, thank you.
It's the same location, just a different curve of the river.
Okay,
thank you. Representative Gunther renews his motion at House File 661, delayed over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance on this bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming and coming up here. The next one is Representative Ethan. Did I see you in the room? I did. I will move from House File 381, delayed over for possible inclusion in Environment Finance on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill, it's to complete really the Ring Dike program, which started in 1997 after the Red River flood that occurred then. $3.1 million was appropriated by the state and equal amount in non-state match. This program continues to operate that way with 50% state funding, 50% non-state. The landowner assumes responsibility for the maintenance of these ring dikes once they're constructed. There have been 250 farmstead ring dikes that have been constructed since the inception of this program. It's been a very effective program of saving farms and farm homes and facilities, equipment, livestock, stored harvest. Our desire here is to complete the project and complete the work that was started with this program. There's a remaining base of $103,000 a year in the DNR. Water's budget, we're asking for another $133,500 increase in that for a total of $236,000. Again, to complete this program, we're looking at 15 more ring dikes to be completed, and the project will have been completed. And it's time to complete the work. I do have Ron Harnack here as well to answer any questions that people might have. And that's my testimony. Thank you.
And the governor's recommendation was, do you want to repeat that again?
I'm not sure what the governor's recommendation is.
Madam Chair, Ron Harnack with the Red River Watershed Management Board. The governor's recommendation was maintaining the base of $103,000 per year.
And when you said the 50-50, the state is 50%, and who pays the other 50%?
The other 50% is broken down to 25% from the Red River Watershed Management Board, then 12.5% from the local watershed district, and 12.5% from the landowner.
We got the figures down. Are there... Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is my first time on this committee, so I don't know. How much does a ring dike cost?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, it's 15 ring dikes that are left and $236,000 for those 15 ring dikes. Not sure how that breaks down exactly.
Madam Chair and Representative, for these remaining ones, we're at a range of between $50,000 and $100,000 for each of the individual ring dikes.
Any other questions from members? Representative Gunther, did you have one?
I have more of a statement. I was there when I first met Ken.
Right.
And I flew over this area with a helicopter, and I can really see and testify the fact that a ring dike does work. And it's really incredible. You see one section of land being filled with water when it finally finds its lowest point in the roads that go around that section, and it's really a terrible thing to see happen.
And Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Gunther. And there is in your packet, I believe, a picture that I think is a good visual of how these ring dikes work. You can see a farm completely surrounded by water.
And Madam Chair, just in addition, when you think about the Red River Valley and Old Glacial Lake Agassiz and how far the water can really spread out, we would not have agriculture in the Red River Valley if it were not for the ability to sustain the economic viability of the farmsteads through some kind of ring dike structure. And this has been a godsend to those that are continuing to farm and in the Red River Valley.
I don't see any other questions, so we will lay the bill open.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You for coming. Representative Purcell, you are... Oh, I'm sorry. Nope, I missed one. Representative Welty, I'm getting ahead of myself. And I will move House File 865 to be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 865, it's a bill that would redesignate the Great River Ridge Trail. In 2006, the legislature passed a bill that designated the Great River Ridge Trail as a state trail. The language included special language that specified that the trail would be officially designated after the Wabasha County Regional Rail Authority entered into an agreement with the Commissioner of DNR and submitted the paperwork. This was a unique circumstance because we wanted there to be a partnership between the state and Wabasha County Regional Rail Authority. Wabasha County Regional Rail Authority did enter into an agreement. It's a legal contract. I have it here with me. And however, the paperwork that was supposed to follow up with the contract was not submitted to the Secretary of State. Again, this is special legislation, and part of that reason was that there was a former county staff member who left the position, a new person was hired, and so in that transition, the requirement for that special paperwork wasn't followed through on. So in 2008, the DNR and myself and the members of the rail group thought that we had a designated trail, but it was found out later that the paperwork hadn't been submitted. But in 2008, the legislature appropriated $1.5 million in bonding for the trail. So the engineering work had begun, but it ceased in February of this year when it was found out, since the paperwork wasn't submitted, it wasn't officially designated. Therefore, the DNR contacted us and recommended that we just go through the normal trail designation process because they already have the legal document on file. So essentially, the Wabasha County Regional Rail Authority held up its end, just the special paperwork saying that this had been submitted when it filed. So members, I would appreciate it if we could pass this legislation, move it to the general register, and get it signed by the governor as quickly as possible so that we can resume the engineering work that already begun, and beyond that, we can get people to work this summer on the trail. And with me is Ron Potter with the DNR, just to confirm that this is the DNR's wish.
Would you want to confirm that on the record, please?
Madam Chair, Ron Potter with the DNR Parks and Trails Division. Yes, we did start work on this, and we would like to resume so we can get this out for bid and get it built this season.
Any questions from members? I don't see any questions. Representative Welty, we have to return this to finance before it goes to the floor. That's part of the protocol. We are a division of finance. And so I will renew my motion that House File 865 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The bill is passed. Okay, now we are representatives to sell. Two more bills, guys. Welcome to the committee, Representative to sell. Would you like to move House File 1618?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would move 1618 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Clean Water Fund recommendation.
Um,
And if I may, to the bill, appropriating $2.5 million from the Clean Water Fund. It's going to go through the Pollution Control Agency for grants. The impetus here is to get some funding out there for using treated wastewater instead of groundwater from the drinking water aquifers, so we can hopefully save ourselves a little groundwater. And this bill the idea came about, and I have information on one instance of the use of this treated municipal wastewater being used, and that is that's actually being done. The information I have is being done over in North Dakota as part of an ethanol plant. So seems like we might be able to do some of this in the state of Minnesota here with a few plants.
Thank you. Any questions from members or a comment from Representative Gunther?
I think this is a terrific bill, Madam Chairman, and I had a bonding bill to do exactly what this is supposed to do, and I think you saw how excited I was.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Purcell. Is there other things other than I know Representative Gunther's got a potential ethanol plant? What would be other examples of industry that potentially would qualify?
Well, I think the qualifications are, you know, going to depend on the wastewater. I'm trying to think here what might come into play. You know, potentially some kind of irrigation if the wastewater was irradiated or something. But,
Madam Chairman, I think this water could also be used to build a power plant that they're proposing to build in southern Minnesota that will use foreign technology to burn railroad ties and telephone poles to produce electricity. It has very little pollution, no odor, and the requirements for water are substantial, so this could also be used for something like that. Taking care of one polluting thing, making electricity out of it, and doing it the right way with water. No groundwater.
Each use would have a different cleanup plan for the water because each of the waters would be different. So one industry might use it one way and one industry would use it another way. So that's why it has to go through PCA for granting. Representative Clark, did you have a question here?
I was just going to ask Representative Gunther about the railroad ties. And we have to be a little bit worried about some of the stuff that's in the railroad ties. And that's the show, I understand. We can have another
question. We're off topic here.
I know. I mean, I almost always agree with Representative Gunther, so I'm just trying to figure out what's going on here.
Like I said, Madam Chairman, Representative Clark, it is technology that came from Germany, and it does work, and they are getting rid of creosote ties and creosote telephone poles by burning it a certain way, and they have scrubbers and stuff to take the odor and the pollution out of there. And it works very. I saw a movie on it. It works good.
Okay. I don't see any other questions, Representative. Oh, you have a question. I'm sorry.
I did. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Purcell, can you use this water on golf courses?
We don't know.
I would speculate that if it was irradiated, perhaps. Have to be sterilized somehow.
I don't see any other questions. Would you like to renew your motion?
Renew my motion, Madam Chair, that 1618 be laid over for possible inclusion.
We will lay it over. And while we're switching chairs here,
Madam Chair, I'll move the minute of March.
12. Representative News moves the minutes of March 12th. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposition? Adopt.
Does the cookie come with the chair? Give me something to feed my mouth here. Thank you, sir. I better wait a minute.
Members, I would like to move House File 1031. She recommended the pass, and she returned to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that she referred to the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division. And what this is a proposal that we developed a 25-year plan for our water, and with the basic notion that when 25 years are up and we have spent the Clean Water Fund, that Minnesotans will know how we have used those dollars well. It will be at the University of Minnesota. Would either the principal, it's the Water Resources, and Professor Deborah Swackhammer would be the principal investigator. And you would know her as the person who led the effort to do our statewide conservation plan, organized that effort, and made it happen. And that was the proposal here is to use the same kind of framework with a lot of citizen involvement and a lot of science, so that we have a process that's fair, inclusive, and transparent. She will organize work teams of water experts involving the whole academic community, University of Minnesota, MinSU, St. Thomas, the State of Philadelphia, Carleton, St. Olaf and McAllister, as well as the private sector. And so what she would be doing, or what the water, the group would be doing, would be, as if you look on page line 121, the detailed framework must include, but is not limited to, identification of infrastructure needs, drinking water, groundwater, surface water, stormwater, agricultural and industrial needs, and the interfaces of climate change, development, and land use and demographics. When we presented this, and this has come from the Environment Committee's representative, McNamara brought up an issue that I thought was legitimate, that I had had the ministerial function of relating between university and the legislature done by the LCCMR. But in writing it, we had the LCCMR actually having the oversight, having to vote on it. So I'm going to offer an amendment. I got the criticism, I'm tired from last night, was legitimate, and I have an amendment, A09, which says, and it should be in your packet, members, that essentially the committee staff shall review the plan and make comments to us. They have that expertise, and it will be useful to have their knowledge as a resource for us. So with that, I would move A09.
Thank you, Representative Guinea. Should move the A09 1065 amendment in discussion on that. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. Further discussion?
I would just
call to your attention one of the things I put in your packet was from Representative Mary Murphy's committee, which is where this bill will end up. And if you would look at, these are, I would imagine, principles that the committee has adopted as a whole. And the fourth one down is create, and it doesn't have a year, but just because people didn't know whether it was 25 or 23, your plan for each fund based on current science and public engagement with outcomes achieved in a reasonable amount of time. And that is what we are trying to achieve with that bill. And with that, if there are no questions, I will renew my motion.
Representative Virginia has renewed her motion that House Bill 1031 be recommended to pass as a matter of return to the Committee of Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendments adopt, or sorry, the House file recommended to pass.
Thank you, members. Thank you. I think we will.
You ready?
I think we can adjourn, but I would mention to members, I think we will have the same kind of conversation about a parks and trails plan sometime next week. So that will be one of the things that will be on our list. We want to get that to Representative Murphy's committee.
Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you, members.